Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
After considering all the facts, my decision is to attend Georgetown University. Yeah!
Let me introduce you to Melisande Short Colombe. She's a freshman at Georgetown University here in D.C.
I have one class in African American Studies. I have a class in Anthropology. I have a Problem of God class, which is a core requirement.
Short Colombe stands apart from her classmates for a couple of reasons. One, she is 63 years old. Another is she's the descendant of slaves, slaves owned and then sold by Georgetown priests back in 1838. The university has granted legacy status to their descendants, like Short Colombe, part of an effort to atone for past wrongs. Short Colombe told me she had no idea about this piece of her history until she got a message on Facebook from a genealogist working to trace the connection between the university and her family.
It was an oh my God moment because I'd read about the connection to families in Maringouin, Louisiana, and did not associate that with my own family, who was from Terrebonne and Lafourche Parish.
And so the aha moment for you was you knew your family had been slaves. You did not know that they'd been sold. And by whom?
I assumed they had been sold because they were slaves. I did not know by whom.
And what did you make of that?
I was sad. I was hurt. I was angry, which is something that I am all of the time for all of my life as a Black American child born in 1954. What is happening here should not be a surprise. This isn't an aha moment. This is history. And this is a part of our American story that we don't talk about. It's the difficult conversation we refuse to have.
And how for you does going and being a student, walking that campus, how does that in some way start to set things right in your mind?
I don't think my being there actually starts to set things right. That's really not what's happening here. And I don't think we should misunderstand that. I made an application and was accepted as a qualified individual to attend Georgetown University.
You had to apply like anybody
else. I had
to
apply like everybody else. I have student loans. I have scholarship. I have Pell Grant. I have work study. I have all of those things that go into being a student and being a somewhat disadvantaged student.
What did your kids say? We should mention you're a mom.
I am a mom. I have four adult children and two granddaughters.
Oh, my goodness. So your kids must be older than the students you're
dorming
with. Yes. You're
my oldest daughter is 38.
And what did they say when you said, I'm going to go back and give this college thing a shot?
This is a mom move. This is a mom move. I used to tell them all the time when they were growing up, when you are adults, you're going to have to call one another to see where I am. I am not the hovering helicopter, have a grandchild so I can have something to do with my life, Mom.
No, that's pretty clear.
I'm the mom who's got to work until she dies. So this is a typical thing for me to do.
I wonder what you feel just walking around campus, looking at some of the beautiful buildings there, knowing your ancestors helped build them and not out of their own free will.
I feel good about it.
Really?
And I feel like I am the... We who are descendants on campus now, there are three of us on campus, and I feel like we are the dreams of our ancestors realized. We are prayers that are answered. We are 180 years in the future of people who were terrified on some days in 1838 when their lives were dramatically changed. And it's taken that long for us to talk about it.
It's a beautiful way to see it. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That's Melisande Short Colomb. She is descended from slaves owned and sold by the Jesuit priests at Georgetown, and now she's enrolled there as a college freshman.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Tonight, some students and community members are upset with Lipscomb University for what seems like a lack of sensitivity at a special president's dinner. The event was called specifically for African-American students, but the menu and the table decorations were shocking to some. The centerpieces featured stalks of cotton, and the menu included cornbread and collard greens. Tonight, News 4 can confirm the cotton floral arrangement was used only on that night. Tonight, we talked to a student who says she and others were greatly offended and confronted the president.
He says that he saw it before we got there. And I said, sir, if you saw it before we got there, why didn't you take it away from us? I said, this is very offensive to us. We are offended. He not once did he apologize. Not once did he show remorse. This is what he says when he walks away. It's inherently not a bad thing because we're all wearing cotton.
Well, tonight, President Lowry says in part, quote, the content of the centerpieces was offensive, and I could have handled the situation with more sensitivity. I sincerely apologize for the discomfort, anger, or disappointment we caused and solicit your forgiveness.
Now, the student who confronted the university president says the apology isn't good enough, that the president had the chance to make it right, but didn't.
I do not think that he means it at all, simply because if he meant it, he would apologize when I first brought it to his attention and told him that we were offended. But he didn't apologize. So I honestly do not feel like there was any sincerity in that.
Now, there was another special dinner the night before this one for Hispanic students. Dinner that evening consisted of a fajita bar.
As your body grows bigger,
your mind must flower. It's great to learn,
because knowledge is power.
It's Schoolhouse Rockin', chip off the block.
We begin tonight with an exclusive story. A Columbus family speaking out involving allegations that a teacher in Muskogee County allegedly used racial slurs when speaking to students in the classroom. In an interview you will only see on News Center 9, our Chandler Morgan sits down with the family for more details on this alleged incident. She joins us live outside the public education building in Muskogee County. And Chandler, what have you been able to find out today?
Barbara, the Columbus family tells me this alleged incident began as the teacher was discussing a conversation with three different students in the classroom. And the family says the alleged incident, it was inappropriate on the language that the teacher used.
Nathan Frazier and his wife, Aquisha, say their 9-year-old daughter, Harmony, was acting unusually quiet during a car ride home from school in early September when the Fraziers asked her what was wrong.
She said another student said to her, she's glad that she's not black. She's glad she's white and she's not black like them.
Harmony, a fourth grade student at Reese Road Elementary in Muskogee County, according to the Fraziers, explained she and two other students were having a discussion in PE class when the student allegedly made offensive remarks. Nathan says Harmony and the two other students rotated back to their homeroom teacher's classroom when one of the involved students told the teacher about the conversation.
The thing that really, really shocked me was when the teacher leans into him. She kind of caressed my daughter's face and said, "Oh, you're a beautiful girl, but at least she didn't call you a dumb black and the N-word."
The Fraziers say once they learned about the alleged incidents, they reached out to the school's principal and had a sit-down meeting addressing the allegations. Nathan claims the principal explained the teacher did admit using the alleged racial slurs. But the Fraziers say they're concerned the alleged situation left a damaging imprint on the students' views.
She hurt my daughter and the other young lady while enabling the other little girl to continue doing it. To our knowledge, they haven't really done much or anything about it.
The Muskogee County School District Superintendent Dr. David Lewis sent Newsletter 9 this statement regarding the situation, saying, quote, "We're aware of the allegation, but as you know, we cannot comment on personal matters. As with any allegation regarding school personnel, our principal, region chief, and human resource department conducted a thorough investigation and followed up as appropriate."
For a child who doesn't see color, she just sees people.
It just hurts a lot. It hurts.
And since the school district deemed this as a private personnel matter, they're not saying if there was any disciplinary action taken against the teacher. And the Fraziers have since removed their child from that school, and they have put her in another elementary school nearby. For now, reporting live, Chandler Morgan for WTVM News Leader 9.
Now keep in mind that I'm an artist.
The interesting thing for me in my work is how easy it is to commit atrocities.
That's artist Carol Walker speaking more than a decade ago at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art.
I mean, that's actually kind of what the work is about. It's just like, if a girl like me can think this stuff, then what? So, I have an uneasy relationship with my own imagination. At the same time, I'd rather make the work than hold it all inside and get strange.
That unease and the atrocity Carol Walker was talking about more than a decade ago, they're still in her work today. Walker's latest exhibit opened recently at the Sycama Jenkins & Company Gallery here in New York City. Rebecca Carroll is WNYC's editor of special projects. She was at the opening, and she joined me in the studio to talk about who Carol Walker is and why controversy seems to trail her in everything she does.
Carol Walker is a contemporary black woman artist who rose to fame in the late 90s with her sort of silhouette images of antebellum figures like slaves, slave masters, Uncle Toms, Mamies. She was awarded the MacArthur Genius Grant in the late 90s, and since then has sort of continued her ascent into the art world.
What's typically in her images that has made her, frankly, very controversial and the focus of so much attention since she rose in fame?
So her images are almost always ferociously violent. There's always an element of sexuality, often incest, rape. It's really about the kind of warring ideals and the set of rules that was going on in Reconstruction and slavery. And so it's both how black and white people interacted during that time, and the way that they interacted during that time were almost always violent.
Now, Rebecca, you clearly have an appreciation for Carol Walker's work, and a lot of people do. But the controversy that has followed her throughout her career has come from other black artists. There have been entire campaigns from fellow black artists against her work. Why?
Most notably, the veteran black artist Betty Saar launched a letter writing campaign against Walker in the late 90s following that first big exhibit, saying that it was, you know, salacious and violent and negative. And I think that Saar felt kind of betrayed in a way as a fellow black woman artist, because we have, if we're given opportunities to reflect, to represent, to explore our culture and our history, the argument is that it should feel empowered, right? That is the expectation. And I recognize and I understand that controversy and that feeling of, why are you subjugating black women again and again and again in this way? Do we really need to see this, you know, do we really need to see this over and over? But I also think that it's a more traditional way of looking at what it means to create as a black woman artist.
So you took a trip to Carol Walker's show, and you took along a young black essayist who's new on the scene and a friend of yours I know named Ashley Ford. Ashley writes about art and culture and gender and race, and was new to Kara Walker, I think. Hadn't really heard much about her or seen too much of her work, but the two of you went on to the show and you brought a microphone along, which is a good thing. So let's listen.
My eyes first went to the trowel,
yeah.
Digging a grave.
The way the tree has no fruit, no leaves, it's a barren tree holding up all of these like images that to me are just like, oh wow. Like, look what this tree has to bear, and it looks like it's like right. sacrificed its right. its fruit to hold it all. And this kid with like the KKK, like the sheet over his head is cutting at it. The fact that he's cutting the branch that holds him up is, whew.
Yeah. But also, you know, we look at this idea of negative images or salacious mm-hmm. images or, I mean, I don't know what it is that makes me feel like there's so much love put mm-hmm. into this work, mm-hmm. if only because of the, you know, the sheer amount of detail. Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you spend that kind of time creating that kind of detail? I mean, look at these boys' eyes over here and the yeah. shape of his lips without feeling love.
How did a young black woman who was brand new to Kara Walker, maybe not party to all the controversy for all those many years, take in this show?
It was deep. She really had an experience. I mean, the one thing I will point out is that we didn't look at the titles of the pieces before we saw it, which made it so much more interesting because it didn't bias at all how we felt about it. But what was kind of oddly gratifying is that the way that we talked about the pieces, then we went back and looked at the titles and they were all sort of like, oh, that's exactly what was going on in those pieces. I think that she, you know, had a real experience, which was great to watch.
Kara Walker herself has said she's not doing interviews around this new show. She seems a little bit sick of all that type of attention, but she has released a statement. What has she said about all of this?
Pretty much exactly that, that she's tired of being the chosen token black woman artist with all the answers to race and racism in America. You know, she's an artist. She is a black woman. She is someone who spends an inordinate amount of time with the work that she creates. And I think that that's really all she wants to do. But when you see the exhibit, or at least from what I took away from it, is that it's not that she is someone who's tired of standing up. It's she's someone who has redefined what it means to stand up. She's someone who has redefined what activism is. This was a call to arms for her. This exhibit is draped with politics and activism and reactivism and what we are living in right now.
Rebecca, talk a little bit about what you think the deeper message of this work in the world right now, in this political moment, is.
There is such a feeling of chaos. And as Walker said in her statement, this feeling of being under threat, if you are black or brown, female, there is a sense that if we don't escalate our emotions and our thoughts and our ideas to this fever pitch, that it will somehow, you know, it will somehow be excavated. So I think that what's so critical, you can't unsee these pieces. And what they say is we are still, certainly black women, black people, black America, living still in the shadow of slavery, living firmly in a body of racist ideology, and that we have to keep creating.
Rebecca Carroll, thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
Rebecca Carroll is editor for special projects at WNYC. You can see photos from Kara Walker's latest exhibit on our website at thetakeaway.org.
The hunt is on. And you're the prey.
This is Fresh Air. The new documentary Trophy stirred a debate at this year's Sundance Film Festival over the complex relationship between big game hunting and wildlife conservation. The co-directors are longtime photojournalists Shaul Schwartz and Christina Clouseau. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The documentary Trophy touches on African big game hunting, breeding, and conservation, and will leave many viewers angry and confused. The confusion is what makes the film extraordinary. Schwartz is best known for his 2013 documentary Narcocultura, which explored the celebration in some Latin American quarters of narcotics traffickers, violent outlaws who nonetheless symbolize a path out of poverty. In the same way, it's not so much the morality of hunting and breeding that engages Schwartz, it's the convoluted economics. Consider the scene in a Zimbabwe rhinoceros ranch owned by John Hume, a man in his early 70s. A woman shoots a rhino, a ghastly sight. But then we see it's a tranquilizer gun, which isn't so bad. But then Hume and his men saw off the rhino's horn. Horrible. But then Hume asserts he saved that rhino's life because the omnipresent poachers won't kill a hornless rhino. The animal feels no pain, he says. The horn will grow back, whereas poachers slaughter rhinos outright. There's a scene that shows the poacher's handiwork you'll want to look away from. If you're an animal lover who thinks traffic in rhino horns, erroneously thought to have medicinal properties, is obscene, this is counterintuitive. But Schwartz and co-director Christina Clouseau give Hume's words weight. An animal doesn't go extinct, Hume maintains, when farmers can breed and make money off it. At the time Schwartz was filming, Hume had 1,300-plus rhinos out of a world population of 30,000. But because South Africa had outlawed the export of rhino horns, he's stockpiling them and losing millions, some of which he'd use, he says, protecting rhinos from poachers. It's also a fact that huge sums for conservation come from fees paid by rich foreign hunters. Justification for big game hunting is problematic, given what Trophy shows of the culture. Schwartz scrutinizes the hunters dispassionately, as one might say a group of animals at a watering hole, in this case Las Vegas, where they gather to explore their prospects for killing and stuffing exotic creatures. One half admires a hunter named Philip Glass, not the composer, for allowing himself to be filmed shooting animals and teaching his young son to do the same, which can't be said for Minneapolis-area dentist Walter Palmer, who went into hiding after luring Zimbabwe's beloved black-maned lion Cecil from a reservation and shooting him. But Glass is tough to admire fully.
When I was a little boy, I remember I had a BB gun. I can vividly remember my mother telling me, you can go shoot birds, but don't shoot a red bird. What did I do? I went and shot a red bird. And I can still remember holding that bird in my hands and looking at its beak and just seeing how beautiful it was and how it was made. Right there in that moment, I realized that there is no way I could have loved that bird anymore, even though it was dead. And I think a lot of us as trophy hunters feel the same way. We just want that experience to go and hunt that animal one time. We'd really just want one.
I don't agree that, as Glass says later, God gave humans dominion over animals, and no government bureaucrat should take that away. But I was willing to listen to his arguments, until the scene in which he's led by expensive guides to where elephants gather and shoots a young one, which takes a long time to die, whimpering. I passed the time remembering a cartoon I once saw of a tiger in an easy chair reading a newspaper under mounted human heads. Trophy continues to stir ambivalence, though. We watch as police break into a shack in the middle of the night and terrify a family as they hunt the father who'd mutilated the rhinos we saw. After the arrest, an affable red-headed ranger named Chris Moore muses that sometimes he's saving animals from these impoverished poachers so that they can be hunted by rich men. Everyone in Trophy has his or her own set of values, and every value is in conflict. The movie is richer in all ways for its tangled sympathies.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
This is my rifle. There are many like it, but this one is mine. My rifle is my best friend. It is my life.
I must master it as I must master my life. Without me, my rifle is useless. Without my rifle, I am useless.
I must fire my rifle true. I must shoot straighter than my enemy who is trying to kill me. I must shoot him before he shoots me. I will. Before God, I swear this creed. My rifle and myself are defenders of my country. We are the masters of our enemy. We are the saviors of my life. So be it, until there is no enemy, but peace. Amen.
A man in Baton Rouge has been arrested for allegedly murdering two black men and attempting to murder another black man who lives near his home. Kenneth James Gleason is his name, and luckily he is in custody. And he had been arrested and let go and then rearrested for other crimes right before he got arrested for these alleged murders. And it was because of alleged drug possession, and then he tried to steal a book. The story is crazy, and I'm happy that he's in custody, especially when you consider what his motivations possibly were. Kenneth James Gleason is thought to have fired at two men killed last week while inside his car before getting out, standing over them and firing additional shots. It appears to be cold, calculated, planned against people who were unarmed and defenseless. That's according to the East Baton Rouge district attorney. On Monday, September 11th, Moore said, Moore is the district attorney here, Gleason fired three shots from a 9mm gun at an occupied home not far from his own. Luckily, no one was hurt in that case. However, following that incident, he did kill two people. The first known fatal shooting occurred Tuesday, September 12th, when Bruce Cofield was killed. Cofield, a homeless man known to people in the community, was fatally shot late that night. And then 2 days later, police say Donald Smart was found with fatal gunshot wounds. Smart was a popular employee at Louis Cafe, a diner near the Louisiana State University campus. Moore said they were able to link Gleason to the shootings early Tuesday when DNA found on the shell casings matched his own. Authorities also spoke to multiple witnesses who identified the same red car that Gleason owns and drives at the scene of these crimes. And so he hasn't been convicted, but he has been charged. And so we'll see how it plays out. But through this investigation, authorities are trying to, of course, find the motive and figure out whether or not this was racially motivated. And so far, they indicate that they believe that's the case, but they need to prove it, obviously. So they're working on that investigation right now.
What kind of book was he stealing?
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, literally my favorite book.
You just made that up.
No,
right?
Seriously, it was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, okay.
What was the rest of that question?
No, the reason why I said is because potentially that could tell you what his idea was. Also, book theft is a very strange thing to be locked up for, but
arrested case, for.
Still are stealing.
Arrested for.
It's not.
Yeah,
no, I don't know. It's, what do we do with this story? This story is a murder story. We hope we don't sit around and wait for the final result, but we keep monitoring it, and if things seem to be getting left behind, we pick up on it. But I look at this as like, this is a terrible, terrible story.
Right.
About someone who keeps getting...
Here's what we do with this story.
Yeah.
This is what we do with the story, okay? We stop allowing the GOP to intimidate us. And when I say us, I mean so-called progressive lawmakers. We stop allowing them to intimidate us from draining resources in the Department of Homeland Security that are dedicated to investigating and countering right-wing non-Muslim terrorism in the country, because that type of terrorism exists, right? So, look, in this case, he attempted to kill a black man, and then he successfully murdered two black individuals. Is it a coincidence that they're all black? I don't know. It might be, but I doubt it, okay? Dylan Roof specifically went into a black church and murdered black parishioners who, by the way, lovingly invited him in there to pray along with them. Right-wing extremism in the country is a real problem, okay? I'm not saying take the resources away from, any type of counterterrorism program looking into or investigating Muslim extremism, but I am saying that, hey, back in 2011, when the GOP intimidated Democrats and convinced them to drain resources from the Department of Homeland Security so there wouldn't be a portion of that organization looking at right-wing extremism, that was a little bit of an issue.
I totally get all those things. Yeah. I totally get all these things. Missing from this story is on arrested suspect's computer is found propaganda related to right-wing extremism. Right now what we have is terrifying person kills black people. I mean, kills people.
Well, targets black people specifically.
So essentially, there is a process that is going to unfold, which is going to fill in all these blanks. I say we keep an eye on it. I just am waiting for the missing pieces to arise. It's good to point it out now, but if it turns out, I mean, just from a strategic point of view, those are all my goals, the goals you have laid out. But my strategic point of view, I wait until we find that missing piece that links.
No, I get it. Look, I get what you're saying because, you don't want to, jump on a story and start assuming things before there's actual evidence. But it's gotten to a point where we're seeing stories like this pop up in the news more and more often. You know, Heather Heyer gets murdered and run over due to white supremacists in, Charlottesville.
Wow. Hey, yo, drama. Hold up. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Let's give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
You know, Heather Heyer gets murdered and run over due to white supremacists in, Charlottesville. Dylann Roof murdered those parishioners at that church. I mean, these stories keep coming up and people are losing their lives. And we have lawmakers and a president that has emboldened this type of hatred. And so all I'm saying is there should be some entity in government that also spends some of our resources investigating extremism, period. Not just a specific type of extremism, but extremism overall. Because it's not just Muslims that carry out, acts of terror.
Right. And we've seen acts of terror here in the United States. 75%?
That's right. We keep allowing conservatives to totally, take control of the conversation, right? And fearmonger and it's just, I want the government to do what the government's supposed to do, which is keep Americans safe. And unfortunately, that is not what's happening right now.
Rhetorically, why can't I jump to all those conclusions immediately? Because when you look at the example of the president, he jumps to those conclusions immediately without enough evidence.
Not Charlottesville.
Right. Well, he jumps to certain conclusions immediately based on what's most politically expedient for him in his weird, instinctive, sixth sense for pandering to bases. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. The one side of me says I would like to jump to this conclusion just because you're doing it. The other side of me says I got to wait because no matter what they're doing, I want to wait until I have all the facts that back up this. I don't want to make the conclusion first. So I have a pattern. I see a pattern. I want to fill in all the blanks to prove that pattern to be something that is actually what's happening before I say it is. That's just it. Well, I mean, I see this. It's absolutely devastating and horrible, and I don't want it to happen.
Well, even the Baton Rouge police chief said on Tuesday following Gleason's arrest that the brutal murders last week probably saved lives because the 23-year-old would have probably killed again.
The arresting of this person who did those.
Yeah, yeah.
So not the murders, but the arresting of the person after the murders.
Yeah, right. I'm just saying, in the end of the day, they are aware that this person was potentially targeting black people. And I'm not saying that we should jump to that conclusion, but in the end of the day, we should be at least a little bit, we should feel a little bit safer now that we have at least one psychotic individual off the streets. Mm-hmm. I guess that's all you can say once you establish that this person is not a race criminal yet.
Yeah. And tie it back to all those goals. I'm completely in support of all those goals.
I would
goals.
Make the argument that
it's
if
just
there
like
was,
this is a.
Yeah. I just think it's interesting that Dylann Roof, just going back to that story, wrote a whole manifesto and was engaged in hateful rhetoric online. And, while the government indiscriminately spies on everyone,
right.
regardless of what you do, even if there's no probable cause or reasonable suspicion, they just indiscriminately collect our metadata. Maybe they should hone in on people who are, you know, sharing threatening material or hateful material online. Like, have a little bit of probable cause mixed in there.
Yeah, but
so you
people...
actually target the right people instead of indiscriminately targeting every American.
Yeah, the cynical but probably true thing is, but those people buy a lot of guns. And I'm going to fund... I'm going to, you know, lobby so that we don't do that thing because I need that person to buy a lot of guns from the gun industry.
And then when that person ends up shooting people indiscriminately or even purposefully targeting black people, then more people will buy guns to protect themselves because they feel unsafe.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
Yesterday, St. Louis police arrested more than 80 people after violent protests erupted over the acquittal of a white former police officer, Jason Stockley. Stockley had been charged with murdering a black motorist in 2011. As the police were arresting protesters, officers started chanting at them. The police officers were shouting the words, "Whose streets? Our streets." St. Louis Post-Dispatch photojournalist David Carson was there when all of this was going down, and he joins us now to talk about what he saw. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
So what exactly happened?
So last night there was a large mass arrest that took place. People refer to this as a kettling, where they group a group of people together and then come in and arrest them. While people were being loaded into the vans, a group of police officers who had conducted the arrest over to the side chanted, "Whose streets, our streets?" And they said it twice, and there was an AP photographer standing next to me, and at first we both thought it was another group of protesters who were coming to confront the police.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no other large group out there to chant like that. And I was like, wow, I think that was the police that chanted that. And so we went over and we asked a group of five people that are standing much closer to the police. They all said, yes, it was the police that chanted that.
And how many police officers are we talking that were chanting this?
It would be hard for me to say, but it was a chorus of police officers that chanted it.
And weren't those the same words the protesters were chanting just last Friday when the verdict came down?
Correct. Whose streets, our streets has been a common protest theme and chant since the Ferguson protests 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And you heard that during these protests. You heard it during yesterday's protests. And so the police were taking the protesters' chant and turning it back on them.
Has the St. Louis Police Department commented at all on these chants by the officers?
I have not yet heard of a statement from the St. Louis Police Department. Speaking with several officers out there at the scene, they both voiced their disagreement with the chant to me.
Personally?
Yes, that they didn't think it was right.
So you've been there covering the protests the last few days. There have been dozens of arrests so far. Does it feel like there's still a lot of tension on the streets, or has that abated somewhat?
The protests in St. Louis are complicated because there are organized protests led by community members here that tend to be peaceful and nonviolent.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's always some other people who come in there that are not going to be peaceful. That's been a pattern in Ferguson, where during the daytime in Ferguson, the protests would generally be peaceful. And then at night, under the cover of darkness, some other people would infiltrate in and commit various acts of vandalism.
Ferguson is so close by, and I'm wondering, how similar does it feel, what you're seeing now, to what happened back then?
So there are some similar people that are leading the current protests that led the protests back and during Ferguson. St. Louis now has a large and activated protest community that can be readily mobilized for protests when the community feels that there's an issue worth protesting about. So,
but the same amount of tension, does that feel quite similar?
I don't know if it's the same tension. I think that Ferguson felt a bit more raw because it just came up. This feels a little bit more like the non-indictment announcement in November of Ferguson than the early days of Ferguson, because people in St. Louis have been anticipating this announcement for a while, for more than a month. After the trial wrapped up, the judge took about a month to announce his decision. And so that is similar in the time between when the grand jury was deciding whether or not it was going to indict Officer Darren Wilson for Michael Brown's shooting.
That's David Carson, a photojournalist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Motherfucking cops are still saying for St. Louis.
Racist quotes on a Facebook post.
Tonight, that image spreading and St. Louis police are investigating one of their own. That meme was posted in response to a woman's post for taking part in protests over the Jason Stockley verdict.
Tonight, she is talking to us. News 4's Eric Cox is live at police headquarters. Eric.
Word is spreading around the web. People online are pushing for the department to condemn the comment and fire the officer.
He needs to be let go. I think that they need to send a strong message that that kind of behavior is not acceptable.
Lisa Clancy says her Facebook post about being a part of protesting the shooting death of Anthony Smith garnered an offensive comment from a St. Louis City Police Department employee, a meme calling the Black Lives Matter movement domestic terrorists. Clancy calls the comment detrimental to the department's image during a time of unrest.
And letting that behavior happen undermines the very trust and relationships that are very important right now, especially when our community is in such a crisis moment.
The most recent city salary database lists that department employee as a 16-year veteran of the force. News 4 reached out to St. Louis City Police. We're told an internal investigation is underway. Mayor Crewson weighing in.
I have heard about that. I have not personally seen that. If that is the case, I first of all, I certainly disagree with that comment, but I've only heard about that.
Jeff Rorta with the St. Louis Police Officers Association confirms someone with the same name as the Facebook poster is a union member. Lisa Clancy claims she's tweeted city police about the offensive post several times and received no response.
I think that their failure to condemn that publicly suggests to me that there's systemic racism in the institution.
Rorta says even if the allegations are true, the only charge the department could bring against that employee is conduct unbecoming of an officer. And even still, he says they can't limit his First Amendment rights. We're live outside City Police Headquarters tonight. Eric Cox, News 4.
The message on Facebook today was loud and clear. Tyler Roysden, a volunteer firefighter for Franklin Township, was involved in a Facebook conversation where he reportedly said if he went inside the burning house of a black man and he had a dog, that he would save the dog first and probably take his time coming back to get the black man. But then the messages get worse. Another post reads, "That's because one dog is more important than a million N-word." People who live here responded quickly.
If he said that, I think he needs to lose his job. He doesn't speak for the people in Franklin. He is but one man.
He should be fired. His job is to save people, not be political in any type of way.
We did reach out to Roysden for comment through his wife, but they declined. She said, quote, "This is nothing but immature drama. Seriously, get a life."
Run that shit the fuck back.
We did reach out to Roysden for comment through his wife, but they declined. She said, quote, "This is nothing but immature drama. Seriously, get a life." Franklin Township Board Trustee Brian Morris didn't appreciate the immature drama. When you heard what was said, what was your reaction?
It's honestly really sad. There's no reason to say anything like that. We're a community that obviously went through some recent things revolving the monument and all that. We don't need that here right now. There's no place for that.
Roysden's wife did respond on Facebook, saying in part, quote, "He admitted that he said things that were wrong and apologized. Everyone deserves a second chance."
People should not listen to this fireman because he is not the people. We the people do not feel the way that fireman.
Franklin Township's not a racist community, and I feel like he should lose his job.
Canada. We should move to Canada.
Last week I told you about Joseph Cow, a man who was riding the TTC right at the end of the X down by the lakeshore and riding a bus back home, getting into a confrontation with a TTC driver and having that TTC driver punch Joseph Cow in the face. Joseph Cao went to the hospital after this happened, and he was told that he has a blood clot in his brain. Now, the last time I spoke to you about this issue, we didn't know about any charges. I was asking, why on earth hasn't the TTC driver, the bus driver, unidentified as of yet, why hasn't he been criminally charged for punching a patron of the TTC in his face? Well, there's an update to that today. There are criminal charges that happened since I last spoke with you. The police have charged Joseph Cao with assault. They have not charged the driver who punched him in the face with assault. And now Joseph Cao has to go to court and face this charge against him when the police refuse to charge the man who hit him. I brought up on the show when I talked about this last week the fact that Joseph Cao is a refugee claimant from South Sudan, one of the most dangerous places in the world right now. Joseph's been here for a long time, and he was actually living in a refugee camp in South Sudan in the 90s when the Canadian government recruited him and said, do you want to come and move and get away from this place and have some more safety and some more opportunities? And Joseph Cao took that opportunity, and he's been in Canada ever since. I brought that up because it relates also to the fact that besides being a refugee and an immigrant, Joseph Cao is black. He's a dark-skinned black man. And I think that that matters in this case. I know that it matters in this case because no one in the city of Toronto is going to tell me that if a black man like Joseph was the driver and that he, as the driver of a TTC vehicle, had punched a passenger in the face, that he would not be facing criminal charges today. Of course he would, and it would be right to charge him because any person who punches someone in the face, but particularly someone who's in a responsible position of authority like a TTC driver, any person who engages in that kind of behavior ought to face criminal charges. The way that the system is set up now is not something that I love or agree with, but that's the recourse that we have. And it hasn't been used, and we have to ask the Toronto Police why they have now decided to turn the victim of a violent assault into the assailant, but they haven't charged or named this TTC driver, who's suspended with pay, by the way, according to the TTC. So that guy is sitting at home making money and not working. The man that he punched in the head has a blood clot in his brain and literally could have died. And I'm sorry to say this, because I very, very much fear for Joseph Cao's safety, but his health is still at risk. Why is this being taken so lightly? Why is there only one story that you can find about this in print on the internet via CBC? How is it that such a blatant assault can take place like this, and there's just such a lack of response? And the TTC, by the way, is covering for their driver and saying that he was defending himself from being punched in the face. The TTC claims that Joseph Cao spat on this driver and that that's the reason why he punched Joseph Cao in the face. Now, as I mentioned last week, there are eyewitnesses to this incident who say Joseph Cao absolutely did not spit in the driver's face. There is video of this incident that the TTC has, and they have not released that video. Joseph Cao obviously also disagrees that he ever spat in the driver's face. But the TTC are covering for this, and they're suggesting that it was retaliation, and the union of the TTC has gone as far as saying that they're not going to put up with this kind of abuse, almost as if to say that they're now encouraging drivers to assault patrons. Now, we haven't heard anything from TTC Chair Josh Cole on this issue. And I think we should. I think we should be hearing from him why this video has not been released yet and when it is going to actually be released to the public. This happened at the front of a TTC bus. There is a camera on the front of a TTC bus, on every bus. There is no reason why we should have these cameras in all of our vehicles if we're not going to be able to have footage in a time like this. You know, I talk about body cameras on this show and I tell you that I don't believe in body cameras for police officers. This is why. Because when the same people we're trying to hold accountable are the ones who control the video that's being kept, they don't give it to us. When they don't want us to see something, they just keep it. How many videos have we seen in this country of black people being shot and killed in the United States, being abused, being intimidated, of non-black people, of all kinds of police activity? How many videos have we seen of body cameras of police officers who were doing something wrong being exposed to the public? Do you ever wonder how the public gets those videos? It's because the police turn them over. It's because the transit officials in the United States turn those videos over to the media. Here in Toronto, we have a TTC saying, oh, we have to review the video. It's not yours. It's the public's video. It's there for public accountability. And the fact that it hasn't been released yet is appalling. Joseph Cao does not deserve this treatment that he's receiving. This, I would say, what's happened here is that a TTC driver did something really, really bad. And now Joseph Cao is being scapegoated in order to cover for the really bad behavior that this TTC driver has engaged in. And Josh Cole, who's the chair of the TTC, you're going to be complicit in covering for the TTC if you don't immediately release this video. You have a responsibility to say something now for Joseph. There is no reason why this video ought to remain a secret. If it's going to come out in court, what's the difference? I mean, is a judge even really going to take these charges seriously? I'd like to know the answer to that question as well. Is a judge really going to take seriously the idea of a TTC driver saying, somebody spat on me, so I punched him clear in his face, and the judge saying, yeah, you know, we need to put the victim of your punch behind bars, or we need to sanction them or punish them in some way? Is that really going to happen, or is the judge going to say, get this out of my courtroom? I really hope that that's what happens, but we're going to wait and see. I mean, more obscene and ridiculous things have happened to black people who are victimized by public officials in the past. The state gets away with this stuff a lot, which is why they're so emboldened to keep doing it. But Josh Cole, you've got to make sure that this video comes out. You've got to make sure that Joseph Cao is actually being protected. What would have happened if the worst outcome had happened for Joseph Cao that evening, being hit in the head and having a blood clot in his brain? What would we be talking about right now? Does somebody have to die in the city of Toronto as a black person being assaulted by a public official before we're going to take it seriously? And by the way, what's up with the Toronto police not charging the driver in this instance? I mean, we all know what's up, but I got to put it out there. Caller to this show last week got upset because I implicated the police in this whole issue. But it's their job to lay charges, is it not? We ought to be upset if the police don't lay charges against somebody during such a blatant act of violence. That's like their only job. But it hasn't happened to this point. So what I'm saying is, the charge of assault against Joseph Cao, that charge needs to get dropped immediately. That's despicable. It's turning the victim into the assailant, and it's a lie. The driver needs to be named. We need to know who he or she is. And that driver needs to face criminal charges for what they have done to Joseph. And finally, all this video footage, all these countless hours of video footage on every TTC vehicle and every TTC station. Well, that's public information. It doesn't belong to the TTC. And they damn well better release that video. Otherwise, we shouldn't be paying to have all these cameras watching everything, because it's not worth it for us as the public. If we're not going to get accountability when something like this happens, get rid of the cameras, because there's no purpose for them.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
Okay, final story for you today. Yesterday on this program, we talked about the punch heard around Seattle. 30-second video of a man wearing a swastika armband downtown getting knocked cold. He didn't file a police report. The cops say he left the scene without giving his name. So you might be wondering, who was that guy wearing the armband? What was he thinking? Well, while we were talking about this story yesterday during the show, we got a phone call from the guy who got punched. He wanted to explain himself. So we called him back. We invited him in. Yesterday, I talked with him about what happened. This man lives in Seattle. We're not using his name on air. He says he wants to stay anonymous because his landlord said she doesn't want Antifa showing up at her property. Here is some of what he had to say. Why did you put on the swastika?
Because I should be allowed to wear whatever I want to.
Are you saying the swastika, you're surprised?
Nazi Germany by how many thousands of years?
Yeah, but listen, I just interviewed an anti-fascist member who said he would have wanted to talk to you, but that he could understand somebody having a violent reaction to the swastika. Let's listen to it. You can hear his emotion.
All right, thank you.
Listen to this.
What that symbol means is lampshades made of human skin. It's jewelry made of human teeth. It's the industrial extermination of an entire group of people, of my family, of my friends, of people like me. That symbol, those words, that ideology is violence.
Can you understand seeing the swastika as an assault, as the threat of violence?
No, because words and imagery are not assault. Actions are assault. And if we start to believe that imagery is assault, then this is rapidly becoming a witch hunt. And now anything that possibly has a relationship to something that wasn't great can now be considered a symbol of hate and used to shut people up, which is me getting punched. That's exactly what that was designed to do.
Well, yes, the swastika is a very old, it's a simple pattern, and it's very old. But it's come to be widely associated with not just hate, but mass murder. And so you're choosing to put the swastika on your arm.
It like
comes across as an advocacy. But how else would you expect people to see it?
I don't know you. And I understand where you're coming from. It seems like a common sense issue. And your question's totally reasonable. I'm not trying to be unreasonable with you. But the hammer and sickle to me represents the deaths of over 100 million people. So as long as Antifa's going to use the hammer and sickle, I'm going to walk around with the swastika. Deal?
Well, you might wear a hammer and sickle and get punched by somebody whose family was killed by the Bolsheviks. I don't know. But as you know, neo-Nazis are much more of a present threat. They're literally on the march. Well, you may not see it as a threat.
No,
but neo-Nazis, you
I mean, I don't agree in this sense. I'm sorry. Let me clarify what I mean when I say I don't agree. Antifa is blatantly anti-capitalist, and they couch that in being anti-fascist. And so they're trying to conflate free market activity with some form of imperialist. You know, they lump this imperialist, capitalist, fascist all into it, and it's not the same thing. And I don't think that's a fair characterization.
But you weren't wearing a fascist T-shirt. We're talking about a swastika.
What does a fascist T-shirt look like? I've never seen one.
What I'm asking is, you brought up a hammer and sickle. I'm just saying, can you understand why a swastika seems
more present? More people die. Why is it more present? We have people literally marching with hammers
and sickles. I'll answer. Because we see people with swastikas literally marching any day.
Yeah,
it happened last week, and it could happen next week. And you might agree with them, but President Trump sees a white supremacist rally that ends in death and says there's good and bad people on both sides.
There's violence on both sides.
Yes.
Nobody wants to talk about that.
But I'm making sure that we're not talking past each other, that we understand why the reaction is different to a swastika.
I don't see why it should be different.
Okay. What did you think would happen in the streets of Seattle? What did you want to happen?
I didn't have any clear expectation in mind. What I really wanted was to be able to go out, walk around for 45 minutes, an hour, and come home without incident. That's what I ideally would have happen in a free world where everything you wear isn't constantly monitored by the citizens' anti-fascist brigade. That's something we should be able to do. And what bothers me is that, you know, quote, news outlets like CNN are trying to characterize, because this is what I'm talking about with the progression. They're now trying to characterize everybody who voted for President Trump as an implicit white nationalist. I think those were their exact words. So at some point, you know, if I walked around with a Make American Great a baseball cap on, I can be stabbed. That's happened to people. The left has made it so that there's no distinction between actual fascism and sort of a conservative point of view. And I think that's what's dangerous for society. And I think that that's what I was trying to demonstrate with my little escapade.
Well, thanks for coming in and telling your side of this story.
Thank you for having me and allowing me to do so.
Again, that was the swastika armband wearing man who you may have seen getting punched and laid out at 3rd and Pine. And I mentioned in there that I spoke with the anti-fascist who was shot in the rally at the University of Washington as the right-wing figure Milo Yiannopoulos was speaking. I talked with Josh Dukes about that punch and about white supremacy in this country and the uses and abuses of violence and compassion. We had a good conversation that you can hear now because we are tweeting out a link to that conversation right now at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll be back at it tomorrow. Hope you can join us.
Well, see again. The people who classify themselves as white are not happy with their appearance. Now, they've taught us to be unhappy about our appearance. You see, but they're very unhappy about their appearance. I think there's an article in the handout about a woman who was, white woman who was in Hawaii. And she said that being around the Hawaiian people and the Asian people, and she said she was tall and white and pale. She said she felt like a freak. And so then she started getting involved in genetic science.
For the first time, scientists have altered the DNA in human embryos to make a fundamental discovery about early human development. Scientists say this proves that modifying genes in human embryos can reveal powerful insights into the earliest days of human life. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein explains.
Tinkering with genes in human embryos has long been considered off-limits because of fears it could mess up the human gene pool or lead to genetically modified human beings. But scientists like Kathy Neacon of the Francis Crick Institute in London have argued that they could make big discoveries about basic human biology.
The purpose of this research is to uncover insights into the function and the role of key genes in this important critical window of human development.
When a single cell somehow begins the journey towards becoming a fully formed human being. So Nikon's team used a powerful new gene editing technique to inactivate a single gene in dozens of very early embryos.
This research is really the first time that genome editing has been used to study the function of a gene or the role of a gene in human embryos.
And the results of the experiment were dramatic. Most of the embryos that had their gene inactivated failed to develop normally. The gene's called OCT4.
So that tells us that OCT4 is really important.
Important because a lot of women can't get pregnant or have miscarriages because they can't make healthy embryos. So this provides clues to how doctors could someday help them.
This is opening up the possibility of using genetics, a genetics tool, really powerful, precise genetics tool, to understand gene function and to unlock a lot of important aspects of our human biology.
The researchers also discovered the gene plays an important role in helping form the placenta, the organ that nourishes pregnancies. And that's not all. The OCT4 gene looks like it's a key player in embryonic stem cells.
Embryonic stem cells have tremendous potential because they can help us to understand and even potentially treat diseases in the future, as varied as heart disease, Alzheimer's, and diabetes.
Because of all this, other scientists say this is a big deal.
It's a landmark study.
Dieter Egli is a biologist at Columbia University.
The human embryo as an experimental system is a new groundbreaking concept that so far very few have dared to walk into. And this is something that Kathy Neacon clearly has done here in a pioneering way.
But the research is also setting off alarm bells for some. While basic research like this could be important, Marcy Darnofsky of the Center for Genetics and Society worries about other scientists trying to take this too far.
The concerns are that we would be opening the door to fertility clinics vying to offer gene editing to make future children taller or stronger or whatever they wanted to market. That could put us into a situation where some children were perceived to be biologically superior to other children.
For her part, Neacon just hopes to learn more secrets about the basic biology of human development. Rob Stein, NPR News.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans
from colonial times to the present.
Gnat's blood, Inuit sun visors, a shoe made from human skin, rare manuscripts, a cyclops pig. They're among the thousands of objects collected by 17th century physician Hans Sloane and part of the first collections of the British Museum. In his book, Collecting the World, Hans Sloane and the Origins of the British Museum, James Del Borgo, Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University, writes about the man who amassed a fortune as a London society physician and assembled an encyclopedic collection of specimens and objects from around the world. He also looks at how the British Museum's controversial origins force us to reassess our view of the Enlightenment, its ideas, and institutional legacy. The book is published by Belknap Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought James Del Borgo to our show. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Good to be here.
In your introduction, you write that Hans Sloane is nowhere because he is everywhere. What do you mean by that?
It's an extraordinary fact that Sloane was, in many ways, almost the most important person in 18th century British science, medicine, and institutions. And even in England today, one thing I was quite surprised by was that most people don't know who he is. His name is famous through places like Sloane Square, but he is the founder of the British Museum. His collections are also in the Natural History Museum and the British Library, and he was also president of the Royal Society and the Royal College of Physicians.
And then he goes to Jamaica in 1687. Why?
He does go to Jamaica as part of making his fortune. He is living at a time when the British Empire is growing and expanding, and Jamaica and the Caribbean and slavery are a crucial part of that. So he goes as a plantation doctor to make money, but he also goes to collect plants. He is a botanist. He is assembling a massive herbarium, plants that can be useful, profitable as drugs, successful new medicines. So the medicine, the careerism, the botany, that's where the collections and the ambitions of this collector originate, and then they will flower into a universal encyclopedic ambition.
You write that it was men, women, and children from West Africa who made Jamaica profitable through their labor as slaves on sugar plantations. How many slaves were the British importing by the late 17th century?
Well, I think the last quarter of the 17th century to Jamaica, the British transport about 77,000 Africans just to Jamaica. So Jamaica is rising at this time. It's coming after Barbados has been established as a sugar island, and it is precisely really at the beginnings. Jamaica in the 18th century will become very, very profitable to the British. Sloane is there in 1687 to 1689 when this is taking off.
And what was his attitude about slavery?
Well, Sloane was immersed in the plantation economy. He is in Jamaica as a doctor. He becomes friends with planters. And so he is part of that world. And really his attitude is that, you know, he's taking full advantage of, for example, the fact that he will travel from plantation to plantation in Jamaica in order to collect specimens. So the attitudes that come out of that are a couple of different things. One is that in A Natural History of Jamaica that he publishes in 1707, he has a very graphic description of the tortures and executions of slaves within his natural history. Again, natural history at this time was a very broad encyclopedic kind of field, not what we think of today. So this was relevant to him to document what Jamaica was as a British colonial possession. And his attitude there is to evince some sympathy for the suffering of slaves, but ultimately to condone and defend the institution as necessary for the profit and the spread of the British Empire.
Now, when I told a British coworker that we would be talking about the origins of the British Museum collection, she said, "We just simply stole everything." And in a recent article for The Atlantic, Sarah Zhang observed, "The British Museum is a museum that holds few items of actual British origin. Its treasures come from afar, often from people that the British variously fought, enslaved, colonized, and or looted from." So should all of the artifacts be returned to the cultures of the world? The Greeks would love to have the Elgin marbles back.
Well, I think in all of these cases, there's a different story as to how the objects get into the collection. The story of the Elgin marbles is very specific. In Sloan's case, he bought a lot of these objects. So one of the themes of this story is the power of a self-made person who becomes very wealthy as a society physician and through investments, using not only his own professional fortune, but also the commercial extensions of the British Empire. So without question, this story of commercial acquisition takes place in this context of empire and slavery. What I would say to that question is that I personally think that museums in general have an obligation to tell the stories of their objects and their collections. And really, I think the job of the historian is to tell that story in as compelling a way as possible and let these stories be told and let people debate what to do about this. And I think it's actually something that makes museums much stronger, much more involving of the public's attention if they actually confront these histories.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, September 23rd, 2017, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations on any of the news clips that we just heard, counter-racist suggestions. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6. You will hear an audio prompt. Press the number 1, and we should be able to see your hand on the switchboard, and I will get you on the line. A couple things before we get to callers. First up, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. The blog address is racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. When you hit the blog, the PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have supported, invested nearly a decade that we've been on the air. Thanks also to folks who have supported us getting items from our wish list. It's linked at Amazon.com. It's under Gus T. Renegade. Wish list is also linked on our blog, posted on our Facebook page as well. Huge thanks to folks who nabbed items from there. I hope the program has been and continues to be worthy of your time and energy. That said, a couple things that I wanted to touch on before we get to the callers. First up, Dr. Amani Shakti Ani. She will be with us on Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. She was with us earlier this year. We talked about the University of Albany incident. Folks recall this was three black female scholars. They were assaulted on a bus in 2016 by a group of white intoxicated passengers. The black female scholars, they were the only ones to face any sort of criminal charges or university sanctions, university punishment. A year and a half later, after expulsions, suspensions, community service, just court cases galore, all of this, Dr. Anish, she'll come back to give us the update on where things stand now and how the University of Albany retaliated against her. But that'll be Monday. Good to have Dr. Ani back on the program, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Next up, I have been playing segments from the Young Turks for about 5 years. I started playing them because listeners have always been great about submitting different clips to play for the compensatory call-in. And I pretty much would have a Young Turk submission weekly. from folks when we first started doing the compensatory call-in. And so I just concluded that a sizable number of non-white people are listening to the Young Turks. And I also got the impression that even some of our listeners, they were submitting these clips, and it was not that they thought Sync and company were racist. It was they were in agreement with the Young Turks. They were fans of the Young Turks. Like, right on. Sync is telling it like it is. That's my man. He's putting it. That's exactly the way I would have said it. That's the impression that I got from at least some of our listeners who, you know, were submitting these clips and what have you. So that was another reason that I've continued to play their clips, hopefully to just further illustrate that this is a pattern of them practicing racism, white supremacy. And in my view, it comes through flagrantly when they talk about issues related to racism, like in the clip we heard today, which, I mean, wow, what a superlative illustration. In that example, I mean, it was so many things. They start off in the clip, all of this effort, lots and lots of words to make sure that we're not identifying some race soldier white person who has killed more than one black person, exclusively, it seems, targeting black people. And the update had literature of Adolf Hitler in his residence. Not that, you know, we needed that. I mean, but bodies in the street. I could see it would be different if it was just me standing on a corner saying, oh, yeah, I think this guy is racist. I thought, okay, you know, that's just taking somebody's word. But I mean, you got bodies piled up in the street and this person has been arrested. Why is there such caution and hesitation to say, man, it seems like this person might have been a racist and just out deliberately killing black people? Why so much caution? In my opinion, that is an act of racism. And then, and they did the same thing last week. Remember with Sync? He was talking about those young white urchins who lynched a young non-white child. Same pattern week to week. And then Anna Kasparian, just like last week, she comes in, the good white person. She leaps in. Oh, no, no, no. It's the no good GOP. They're the ones who keep us from passing correct laws to go after white terrorists. It's not all Muslims and blah, blah, blah. That right there, in my view, a more sophisticated method of practicing white supremacy, because, again, it is minimizing the racists are just the Republicans. The racists are just the GOP members. The racists are just Donald Trump, the Tea Party, their supporters. Nothing could be further from the truth. That is another slick tactic that I think a lot of victims of white supremacy do not understand. Then, our very own Anna Kasparian, she comes back again. These types of incidents, killings, I presume, these types of things are happening more frequently. What is the first thing she mentions? Heather Hare getting killed in Charlottesville. I think I've said consistently, white people love those type of incidents. She will be, not to use a metaphor, but the same manner that whites worship and praise and mandate that other non-white people worship and praise John Brown, the same sort of treatment is going to happen with Heather Hare. You're seeing it right now. We've seen it for the past month or so already, and that's just going to continue on infinitum. And it's dangerous because, number one, it gives the suggestion that not all white people are racist. This Heather Hare certainly wasn't, right? And then also, white people are victims of white supremacy. That's the first example that she gives, that there are more of these types of incidents of white supremacist violence is a white person being killed. And then she gets to Dylann Roof, and oh yeah, he did kill all those black people at the church a while back. That's ancient history, though. Heather Hare, that's recent. That's right now. Very, very slick. And in my opinion, dangerous, consistent with what they do on a weekly basis at the Young Turks. Let's see, what else did I want to make sure that I got in? The report on the CRISPR technology, I thought was really, really significant, because that's one of the first times that I've heard the application of this technology to resolve or rectify any problems that white women might have with fertility. Dr. Welsing, I wish we could have got her commentary on that specifically, but anytime I hear any talk about correcting fertility issues, you automatically know that they're talking about white women. This technology is never taken to the continent. They are never sprinting for Henrietta Lacks to get them technology that will help them be more fertile so that they can have more black babies. That never happens anywhere in the universe. So I thought that was important in terms of how this technology might be used, or at least one way it might be used. Next up, the incident in Seattle where this suspected race soldier wearing a swastika was allegedly punched. Any type of incident like that, I am very suspicious about. It's easy to stage things. I think this came up last year during the presidential campaign where people were getting punched at Donald Trump rallies left and right. And I had some suspicions about some of those incidents being fake. Master deceivers. But I thought with that incident, just everything about it, this person getting punched, going around harassing people, the police of this part of Seattle, this is like in the middle of downtown Seattle. They have police there all the time, day, night. I mean, major, major intersections. This is like blocks away from Pike Place Market where they do all the fish throwing when they show Seattle on television. For no one to be arrested and then the person who gets punched after that, and they have images of this and everything, and then the person is doing like a media tour about the incident later. I mean, just everything about that strikes me as being super phony and in some way designed to benefit the system of racism, white supremacy. I could be in error. Next up, down in St. Louis again, they've had like a week of protests and what have you. I think I played two different reports, one where the enforcement officers were shouting, "Whose streets? Our streets." Talk about what they call cultural appropriation. And then the next clip, it was about a specific suspected race soldier for the St. Louis Police Department posting a meme that said Black Lives Matter domestic terrorists. And it was not in the audio segment, although it was written on the news report. The meme also said Klan with a tan, talking about Black Lives Matter. Klan with a tan. Continuing. Also, last thing, the first clip that I played with Miss Short Cologne. She is a black female student, 63-year-old freshman at Georgetown University. She is one of their quote-unquote legacy students, one of two currently enrolled. The University of Georgetown, they sold 272 slaves in 1838. They were floundering, and they used this money to pay off their debts, and they sold them down the river to Louisiana. And the descendants of the 272 that were sold, their descendants now number over 5,000 that have been identified. Miss Short Cologne is one of those descendants. And they have Georgetown. They've been in the news a lot over the last year or so talking about this sale and identifying these people and atoning and reconciling. And I'm writing a report about all this, basically saying that they, like I would expect from whites, have done absolutely nothing. They didn't give a scholarship, or I'll put it this way. They didn't give free tuition to Miss Short Cologne. They didn't write her a big check so that she has no loans, no financial worries for her 4 years of education, nor did they do that for any of the other descendants. They haven't went out to find them and encourage them to come to D.C. and get a world-class education that might better their lives for a school that has a $1 billion endowment, billion. They haven't done that at all. It's just been the same tacky and trifling conduct. But it was great. I interviewed Miss Short Cologne. I spoke with her Friday morning for about an hour to get more details and to write up my report. But you can look for that. Should be coming out sometime in the next couple of days. With that, if I could request for this program exclusively, if we could not use metaphors, I think I just mentioned the St. Louis suspected officer in St. Louis, suspected racist in St. Louis who posted this meme, Klan with a tan. That right there is why, or that is a great illustration of why on this program, I encourage no metaphors, just for this program, because racists like that will use metaphors, analogies, similes, comparisons to compare two entities that are not similar at all. That is a major way that white people practice racism. That is a major way that whites practice deception. It generates confusion. They are extraordinarily skilled at it. Klan with a tan. Victims of racism, we have been exposed to this behavior for all of our lives. We picked up some of that. We've picked up some of that conduct, and we are still learning, Gus T. Renegade included. As such, sometimes we express our thoughts on ideas where we are still thinking, and sometimes we'll use a metaphor to convey our thoughts, hoping that metaphor accurately conveys what we mean. Often the metaphors do not. They generate more confusion. They do not aid in establishing clarity. If we could just be explicit, exact with what we want to say, that would be greatly appreciated. I will prompt about that. Again, no metaphors, just for the compensatory call-in. Also, if you could limit your commentary to 5 minutes, whatever it is that you want to say, if you could just take 5 minutes to say it. If you have additional commentary, if you could wait until everyone has had at least one opportunity to share, and then you can add your additional commentary. I also would like to ask if folks, if you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be greatly appreciated. I want to help preserve the quality of the broadcast. So you can say whatever you need to say. And then once you're done, if you can mute your line, that would be grand. And you can unmute yourself when you're ready to speak again. The number to dial, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how's it going, everyone? Good evening, Gus. This is Keita. So I guess I'll start with the whole British Museum, the segment about the British Museum. It seemed pretty, well, it seemed exactly what I would think the British Museum does and what they did. They essentially went around the world, took artifacts from different cultures, and they keep them in that museum. But one thing I noticed that is very dangerous about that museum is because the British control those artifacts, they control the narrative around them. So for instance, if you go to the British Museum now, you will see a collection of bronze heads from the Benin or the Yoruba culture in what is current day Nigeria. And the story around those heads is essentially the British came to what is now Nigeria to where the Oba or king of the Yoruba people of that empire were, and there was a battle over slavery. The British say one of the official lies from the British is that they helped to abolish slavery in that part of Africa, and those heads were acquired through a war. But what is interesting about that is not what the locals say. The locals say their kingdom actually was not involved in any type of slave trade. As a matter of fact, every time the British came to them for workers or slaves, they told them, you can go fuck yourselves. We're not about to sell our people. And I think it's very
G-rated.
Important because...
Oh, Remy, G-rated, please.
Sorry. Excuse me. And what's interesting is that if you look at genetic analyses of ancestry of various peoples in the Western Hemisphere, you find that a lot of them were from that same stock of Yoruba culture, which is why one of the religions is so big in this part of the world. And I just using logic, I find it hard to believe that people were actually selling off their brothers and sisters. And it seems more like the Europeans were able to essentially conduct a multitude of raids. They were able to destabilize a multitude of economies, and they ended up getting we ended up being able to capture people. But the official notice, but what the British are saying is that they bought them, which is completely false. But, you know, since they control the artifacts, they control the story. And I'll mute my line from there.
Appreciate that. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you wanted to share, your line should be open. Proceed. Folks with a hand up, I guess, are spectating. If you have a hand up, let's roll today, please, as opposed to waiting and hanging out to see what other folks are going to say.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, that would be helpful.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Hello to everyone. This is Red from Ohio. Real quick on the commentary about, I'm sorry, the segment about Columbus, Georgia, and the teacher saying, caressing the little girl's face. I think it was a little black girl, and she was like, well, you know, you are pretty, and, you know, basically using the N-word almost in like a descriptive manner. And I feel like that's something that I have encountered when I was actually in middle school. I feel like it was a white, now that I think about it, I feel like he was a white man. He had like a, what I guess we would call a Spanish name. And I would think that he would be classified as white thinking back on the situation. And when we were taught about the Holocaust, which we had extensive teachings about the Holocaust, didn't really have probably about one or two pages about the civil rights era. That's basically it. But he was basically trying to let primarily a class of black students, males and females, to try to make them understand how the plight of the Jewish people were, the white Jews basically were so horrible. And he used, well, you know, well, it's hurtful when someone calls you a spick or a nigger. And it always stuck with me because it just seemed like I didn't think that someone, especially a teacher and someone who looked white, should say that, even if they're just trying to explain, well, that's not a good thing to say. Now, on my commentary, I went to, also, of course, I've been continuing my research on the heroin epidemic. And on Netflix, and I did think it was a constructive, a constructive documentary. It's not about Ohio, but it is about West Virginia, which is not that far away. It's just right underneath Ohio. Is a documentary called Heroin with the E in parentheses, and it kind of discussed the epidemic in West Virginia, and one of the white female prostitutes. She was going to come to a rehab in Ohio. Now, the other thing that I wanted to report on this week was I attended a open house for a black child who I know. I'm close to his mother, and the main thing that I noticed was that his teacher, a white man, he has his classroom basically set up. He calls it a platoon. And their name, I guess the different classes have different names, and their name is Team Boot Camp. I asked him, and definitely was standing in the question lane, asked him, well, why are you doing, you know, basically what was the motivation behind it? He was like, well, it was basically, paying homage to, the military. The main thing, and I have a lot, but I'm going to try to stay within this 5 minutes. The main thing was that I was in the, he made several different, I would think, suspected racist comments. He had, it was in the classroom because his mother wanted to stay back in the classroom and speak to the teacher alone. It was his mother, it was the child's mother, father, and myself. And he was like, well, you know, you're doing a whole lot. He basically was talking to the child. It's like, you know, well, you're doing a whole lot better. You actually have a support system. You have all these people around you. and he used the term, when he was describing how, you know, how their school system is run, or how that the school system is within that school. Sorry, that's probably not the right words to say. He said, well, we're not like the lily white suburban schools who hold your hand all throughout the year. We basically will only hold your hand. These are his words, not mine. We will basically only hold the children's hands, you know, just kind of help them with lockers and stuff like that. And the child's mother, she didn't know what lily white meant, because I talked to her outside of it, and I'm outside of the school, and I'm like, yes, he used that term. Lily white means, you know, the whitest of the white. And then she later on went to research it. That's all I'll add for now. Thank you for allowing me to share.
That's great. If you, anyone, if you have the time to help out Lynch Services, if their parents, if they're going to meet teachers and maybe they don't feel comfortable, if you just want to pitch in, or if you actually care about the child, I cannot imagine it being something that would be frowned upon if an uncle or an aunt or a grandparent or, you know, just a family friend wanted to also participate in a child's meeting at school. I can't imagine why, as was stated, the support system would be rebuked from the schoolhouse. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we've not heard from you, a line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Peace to the callers, to the hosts, and to the platform. I just wanted to speak on a little bit maybe about the area of people activity called war, that we commonly call war. And basically, you know, this week we had a lot of talk from Trump and the racist white supremacist ideology about wiping a group of non-whites off the map because of their, you know, political agenda, which politics is another area which everyone is engaged in. And I just found that, I found it to be strange that, you know, here is a white nation talking about eradicating the non-white nation, but if non-white nations were to treat white nations and white people like Trump is trying to treat North Korea, then, you know, there would possibly be no more white people. And so I found that very interesting this week that the powers that be are instigating war with each other while black people are basically subject to the war, since we're not participating in any kind of formal government of our own. We don't have any formal army. We don't have any of these things on the international playing field. And so I think that that's very vital to our survival, that, you know, if everyone else is participating in war and we are not, or we are confused about who we are fighting for, what we are fighting for, I think that those things hold us back. And I've noticed that our differences in religion and spirituality is one of the main things that keep us from enacting something in real time, manifesting it in real time and saying, hey, we identify like this, this is what we think, and we're willing to fight for what we believe, or die and live for what we believe, just like most other nations of people. And I just wanted to add that black is not a nationality. And we consider ourselves African Americans, and I think that whatever parts of America we like, we can take with us. And I don't think that we will really have a good option or chance until we decide that we want to change our situation, whether that be formally leave and gather together under some governance of our own, because if we're not governing ourselves, other people are governing us. And until we're ready to be our own police and our own judges and all of that, I really don't understand what the black people are talking about. That's all I wanted to say.
Yes, sir.
Other folks who have dialed in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Thomas in New York.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I wanted to say, man, this has been an interesting week as far as the political, the political spectacle. But what packed me up was the president of North Korea calls Trump a dotard. And I never heard this word before. I said, man, what the heck is a dotard? So I had to look it up, of course. So I went to the 1828 dictionary, and it was there. It was shocking because I thought this was some word he done made up, you know. And one of this definition is a man whose intellect is impaired by age, one in his second childhood, and the sentence is the sickly dotard wants a wife. And the second one, a doting fellow, one foolish fond. Now, I said, wow, you know, this is strange. So I then looked up in the 1828 dictionary, retard. And I was shocked that retard doesn't mean what we think it means today. One for retard is to diminish the velocity of motion, to hinder, render, more slow in progress, to retard the march of an army. A resistance of air retards velocity of the cannonball. Also to delay, to put off, to render more late, as retard the attack of old age, or to totard the rupture of nations. So it seems like the metaphor for what a retard is what the definition of what a retard is today. And I guess the word we should be using that should be ostracized, because now you can't use that word, retard, should be dotard. But I just thought that was very interesting. And also, today he calls him the chief calls him a megalomania. So I couldn't find that in the 1828 dictionary, but I did look it up. And I thought this definition was very impressive. Obsession with exercise of power, especially in the domination of others. Self-importance, egotism, conceitedness. He's blinded by his own megalomania in quest of historic recognition at any cost, is the definition. Is the sentence they used. The delusion of one's power of importance. And then it went on to name people who have been megalomaniacs. One is Caligula, and as a counter-racist experiment, I would advise everyone to find that movie and watch it. It'll give you a lot of insight on white pathology and white sexual deviancy. But they went on to name a whole bunch of things associated with this megalomania, and to me it describes all white people perfectly. Delusions of being superior to others, delusions of greatness, delusions of having great social and political power, lack of empathy for other, delusion of importance, egotisticness, violent tendencies, self-centered, wants others to fear them, high, mighty confidence, manipulation of others, exaggerations, feelings of being famous. It goes on. To me, it just described the white supremacist perfectly. Either way, I'll go on to say I want to... the lady who went to school, I didn't hear all the clips. I heard the beginning and the last ones because I was traveling in between. The lady who went to school at Georgetown University, and she wanted compensation. She went there to go to school, and they told her that, you know, this was her ancestors were slaves there, and they helped build the college. Now, in my opinion, I would want compensation. I don't want to go to that school. I want my family to get compensated for their labor. I would like to know how many of these kids' tuitions y'all should be handing over to my family every year, because I'm sure Georgetown is not cheap, especially the people housed in the buildings that my ancestors built. I want some of that money, too. I just feel like, you know, to send them to school to get education is a slap in the face, especially it doesn't add up, because you own nothing still at the end of the day. And studying logic. And the clip that came on right after that, the person said something to the effect of, I don't raise my kids to see color. And I hate that metaphor, because logic doesn't kick in when we use that metaphor. You always talk about metaphors, Gus. See, when we use the metaphor to make our conclusion as per what that statement means, our brains automatically associate the opposite of seeing in color as being someone who sees in black and white. And that's not logical. And if they were teaching their kids to see in color or to see in black and white, they wouldn't be confused, neither will their kids. What they're really saying is, I'm raising my kids to be blind. That's what they're saying. Because, you know, it just doesn't make sense, and I really hate that they use that metaphor. The NFL, did Trump call black women bitches? I mean, he said these sons of, you know, but I guess there's really nothing we could say. All he has to do is play a couple of songs. I expect everyone black tomorrow to take a knee, and I'm going to be very disappointed in those who don't. I don't have high expectations, but I just think with the climate that they will. I respect the NBA players for speaking up, especially LeBron. Big up to him speaking up again. I would also like to say that the baseball players, we haven't heard anything from them. Most of them coming from Dominican Republic, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Central and South America, and being black or brown, very melanated. We don't see them taking a knee and not coming out the dugout or speaking up in any of these things, which I hope everyone remembers when it's time for the Dream Act coming up and this wall building. I'm sure they're going to want a lot of black people to protest on their behalf. I don't think we should. In the human genome clip, to me it seems like whites are trying to make Captain America. And I'll mute my line.
Right on. Slap in the face, that is a metaphor. And Mr. Fuller actually does use the word retard with that older sense of the word in terms of being developmentally delayed. I think he uses it on a pretty regular basis in saying that he has been greatly retarded by the system of racism, white supremacy. And in fact, I used it myself in that manner, even though sometimes people will look at you a little curious because they, you know, might think you're trying to call them a name or something else. But yes, he is.
Yeah, what I was trying to show was that it doesn't have anything to do with people. It has to do with slowing something else down.
Right.
The word that has to do with people is dotard. But right. They have us, they're using the metaphor of what retard is, and that's the new definition for retard. It's a slow person, but it really is just a slow, something that's being slowed down by velocity. Or by the water, slowing this shit down, something to that nature.
Understood.
That's why I brought that up.
We got it. We got it. Thank you kindly. Again, that's the sense that Mr. Fuller uses the term exactly the way that you described it for us. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace to Gus, peace to the host, peace to everybody listening tonight. This is V from Central New York, and unfortunately I'm a little short on time, but I have four quick observations to make. Not even observations. The first one, I have noted as I've been continuing my research on YouTube with the alt-right, I have noticed they have started not only downvoting alt-right women videos, but they have, in many instances, taken down or disabled accounts that were predominantly ran by alt-right women. And this has skewed the number of videos discussing alt-right women issues towards the quote left, meaning the Young Turks seem to be some of the most favored videos that pop up when you research the alt-right women videos. Whereas a year ago, you could find dozens, maybe hundreds of more videos from actual alt-right women members. Secondly, I heard a caller reference the Jewish Holocaust and the genocide in World War II. And every time when I hear that, and I hear that a teacher is forcing their children to learn that history, not a negative history to learn from, or a negative concept to force them to kind of learn the lessons of that, I'm often reminded of what Dr. Ben pointed out, that 5 million Hebrew, black Hebrew men, women, and children were killed at the same time, during the same war, on African soil, and that has never been classified as genocide, nor has it received any type of museum marking its completion. Third, I journeyed down to the barbershop for a haircut this week and discovered a new barbershop along my street. It was run by a Puerto Rican, a so-called Puerto Rican man, who is very dark-skinned. Upon sitting down in this chair and talking with him for some time, he turned the discussion towards racism and Black Lives Matter and expressed a sentiment that he felt Black Lives Matter was unnecessary and that Black people often made excuses for the issues which they confronted on a day-to-day basis. He continued to list a couple Black men and one Black woman in the area in which I live who had, quote, seemed to do well despite all of the pressures placed on them by white people, unquote. That came directly from his mouth. I didn't actually argue with him about this. I just listened and kind of, you know, offered a quip here and there. And then towards the end, he made a mention of interracial dating. And he said, quote, I don't understand why some Black people make such a big deal of interracial dating. I, for one, he said, am married to a white woman. Should it be a big deal if I decide to marry a white woman? And he continued along that route for about 25 minutes, bringing several topics back to that specific area. I didn't challenge him nor offer any criticism. I just listened. And I found it quite interesting. His shop is actually located along the main street of the community which I live in. There are no Black-owned businesses along that street. His is the only person of, quote, minority status that is there. And then finally, I've been rereading Amos Wilson's book on Black psychology. And as we enter this wonderful genetic age where, you know, white people are attempting to change their genes and ours along with them, I remind everybody that in the 1970s, white people changed the story they had been telling us. That before the 70s, Black people were still inferior. But suddenly in the 70s, we became just like them. Amos Wilson has a fantastic body of research. Even if you don't read his books, just reading the references which he listed, which detail that white people discovered in the 70s, in many instances, we learned quicker than them, we learned more completely than them, and we were able to act more decisively with that knowledge than them. In other words, they didn't discover that we were inferior. In many ways, they discovered we had superior qualities than what they had previously thought. I thank you very much, Gus, for the work that you have been doing this week. It was very much needed. Peace to you. Peace to your home. Thank you, everybody.
Indeed. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up and we've not heard from you, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings to you, the host, the callers, and the listeners. This is Mohandisi. I had a question as to how many white people actually exist, how many ICE albinos actually exist on Earth currently. Like, is there anybody, has anybody looked up those numbers? I've been looking up the numbers for a couple years. And I think back in 2012, when they were talking about a lot of their fertility problems, I've seen a few people saying that their numbers were around 850 million. Of course, those numbers are boosted by other people of color and all this other sort of thing. But I was just wondering, like, what's their numbers so that we can actually, you know, start marking off how many are leaving, you know, until they're not here. I'd love to have that countdown. And then the other thing is, you know, I've been all around this country, in particular this North America, you know, to just about most of the states, and even, you know, driven from nearly one coast to the next. And I still can't for the life of me figure out how did these ICE albinos conquer this land? I mean, it's really vast. I can't really figure out how they did it. I can't figure out how they conquered the entire globe, you know, for us to be so smart and, you know, be able to think better than them and all this sort of thing. I just can't figure out how this is working. But anyway, I just really want to know, like, what's the number? Does anybody know how many white people exist? Thank you.
I do not have a number. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, you have commentary you would like to share, lines should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, everybody. Gus, listeners. First, I'll comment on the Georgetown legacy policy. I concur, it's an empty gesture. Ms. Cologne stated herself she doesn't think her attendance is effective as a reparation move, and then stated later that matriculation is not automatic or a guarantee. I had a question to ask of everybody, if it's not too late. It kind of builds on Mr. B's in Central New York question or statement. I want to ask about buying black strictly. Have other listeners found it effective? Gus, if you have an archived broadcast that I can refer to that deals with that issue, or do you have an up-to-date directory of black-owned businesses? I'll mute my line.
I know that there are several directories. I've shared one before. I think that's the sort of thing you can just Google it. I don't live in an area that has a lot of black people or black businesses. So that's not the sort of thing that, you know, is going to be as helpful to me in terms of going out and actually being able to go to places. But, yeah, folks, if you do have an up-to-date registry or listing in terms of where you would recommend people go to check out to purchase, buy for black-owned businesses, feel free to share. You can post it. I can share it on our Facebook page as well. Other social media sites so people can access the content. Let's see.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, this is Keita again, and I just wanted to.
Oh, wait a minute. Hang on a second. We're not doing repeat folks yet. I want to make sure I get everybody who has not spoken at all, and then if people want to share and comment, questions been on the table, or if someone has asked a question, we should have time after everybody gets one opportunity to speak. And then if you've already spoken, you can share again, answer the question, or add any other commentary that you have. Do we have people?
Okay.
Thank you, sir. Do we have people that we have not heard from at all? If you are interested in sharing, that would be grand. Do we nab everybody with a hand up, or do we have people with a hand up who are spectating, just hanging out and not saying anything?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I had also caught on to that audio segment with the Young Turks and the caution that was used, practiced, along with the racism, definitely, where they was, I think the lady was talking about non-Muslim right-wing extremism, and she kept using the word extremism. Like, I guess it's a lot of people doing something or whatever. And it did, like, I can imagine people, non-white people, becoming very confused if they were listening to something like that. So if there's a large non-white following that listens to the Young Turks, I can see them not only being, I guess, fans of it, but starting to adopt the same type of rhetoric or, like, terminology that they absorb from that type of broadcast. So that's very, very interesting that they are using that type of language, because it does continue that pattern of where they are saying racist can only be, I guess, a part of the GOP, and the GOP is telling us to hush or preventing us from speaking out. It sounds like she was saying something of that sort. And it doesn't really get into discussing what racism actually is, and making that just insulting comparison about the white lady, you know, even though she lost her life, but that's not the same as the Dylann Roof situation. And this guy, I guess he was in Louisiana, I believe, and him pretty much worshiping white supremacy. And, like, how can they link people like that to a Republican? It seems like they just constantly try to just, you know, make it just a fraction or segment it into that small area, but they're not really giving no kind of examples as to how this is, you know, quote unquote, right-wing extremism instead of this, like, racism. You know, they're saying that it's, you know, alleged. That's another term that they'll use. Alleged, and, you know, probably, and they won't just be clear and direct with the act of racism. So, you know, I'm definitely trying to think up a term. I agree with you on that. Like, it should be like a term for that and a definition for that type of practice or that strategy they like to use, that tactic. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to speak.
Indeed, appreciate that. Other folks, if you have a hand up, if we've not heard from you at all, you should speak now.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, beautiful people. There were a couple things that kind of stood out to me in this week's compensatory call. There, for the clip about the poachers, I think it's a guy in the documentary is speaking, and he says that when he killed the little red bird, that was very chilling for me. It was probably one of the weirdest things, but not weird. It made complete sense for the scant understanding I have of racism, white supremacy, and white people, but it's chilling. That don't kill the red bird. So I killed it anyway. And when I held it in my hands, I couldn't love it more, even though it was dead. I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty much what he said. And that just is completely antithetical, opposite of all other ways of viewing love and life and respect for life and everything. Like, there's even sayings, and I don't know who says it, but if you love a flower, you don't pick it just so it can live, and that's a flower. So when it's expanded to encompass, you know, living animals and whatnot, and lions, and, you know, and then when I think about it even more, to think that the psychosis is so bad that it's something like an addiction, that the animals are going extinct because of this desire to kill, this love of killing and glorifying it by hanging the dead things that you kill on your wall. I mean, that's really white or Eurocentric. I think, I can't remember exactly what white male said this, and it could have been in the Young Turks thing clip. He says that he's seeing a pattern. So he wanted to, it was the whole thing. He said pattern like three times. And he's like, I see a pattern, so I want to apply the pattern, and then I want to fill in the blanks and make the pattern apply. And I was just like, you know, yeah, that's a great way. Like, that's something, like, that's a codified way to teach children that we should teach children and ourselves be thinking about finding patterns and observing the pattern and being able to predict based off of patterns. It's a very scientific, logical way of thinking. And it's unfortunate that for them, that seems to be like a standard. For white people, that seems to be a standard in a way of thinking. But it becomes unapplicable to racism, white supremacy, or white people, because if that is the case, then to see a pattern in white people and just be able to make conclusions about white people, we would be able to do that very quickly. But I also thought there was something strange about the Seattle punching, but I didn't even think maybe that it was, I mean, it was just the way that he was speaking on the interview. He didn't want to interview, but then he reached out and said that he wanted to interview. And then the way that he was so, I want to say even like articulate, not to be weird using that word or whatnot, but that he was very articulate and almost coached. He seemed too ready. Like this, like, I don't know, maybe he's spoken before on radio shows and whatnot, but he seemed just prepared. Like this wasn't his first time. And if you're just an average Joe or just a regular person doing what you're doing, wearing what you're wearing, why would you sound that way? So he sounded very strange to me. For the Kara Walker piece, I've looked at some of her work. And when I was first listening to it, I just, you know, she does what she does. She did what she did. She does what she does. She's doing what she's doing. She said what she said. And I respect her for doing her. At the same time, just an alternative perspective on art is that, yes, it can be used to deal with past traumas. But sometimes I think we as non-white people and victims of like the most gross of oppressions ever to be on the planet have an inclination or a tendency to relive that and express that over and over again. I haven't seen the new picture, so I don't know what her new work is, but to not cross over into the imaginative of the future so that we can actually use art to open up a portal so we can see what would be possible. And that's not our fault. It's so much pain and so much hurt. I think we're just trying to process, but I do think that there's some healing ability and alternative perspectives on how to do art. It doesn't always for Black people have to be slavery and oppression in that way. You know, we can expand beyond that so we can see, you know, into the future a little bit more. And then this is the last thing. It's not about a clip, but just something I'll say. I've been stressed, taxed in many ways. And something that I was always thinking about, because I try to keep all my contact is with non-white people, specifically Black people. So, you know, we're all victims of this system. So meaning we're all hurting in some way, hurt people, hurt people. And so, you know, sometimes there might be a desire to isolate or something like that. And, you know, everyone makes their own choice. That's not mine. So I like to be with people. I like people. But sometimes, you know, things happen. And so when I was thinking, you know, reduce conflict. So one way is to minimize contact. I totally understand what Mr. Fuller is saying. But even if that didn't work and say I had some contact and it didn't go well and there was some conflict, my code, and I'll just share it in case it could be helpful for maybe somebody else out there, is to still just be kind and process the hurt or the conflict in a way that doesn't create more conflict. You know, you do the best that you can, and sometimes it doesn't work out. But can still be kind. And I think that can help in ways too. So thank you all for listening.
Indeed. Right on for being courteous to other non-white people, other Black people especially. Other folks we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace. Greetings to you, Gus. This is Ross, and peace to Emmy. Big up to you for Black Self-Respect, Thomas, and everyone else who called in and who's listening on the line. Peace to each of you. I wanted to touch on three things that are separate from the clips, but I didn't get to hear, but one of the callers was talking about the British Museum. And, man, the British Museum has some serious history to it. The British Museum itself, the Vatican, the basement of the Vatican, and the Library of Congress, together they have more stolen artifacts from non-white people than any other places on earth. I mean, like, there's miles underground in the Vatican. If I understand correctly, there's a couple of levels that run very long under the Library of Congress with stolen artifacts from Africa, the Americas, you name it. And I remember many years ago, Dr. Ben had a lecture where he was discussing that when he had taken a group to the British Museum after going to the Nile Valley, that in the basement of the museum, they had some of the kings on display that were not the original mummies. They were actually, like, I guess, like white people who they mummified. And when you mummify white people, their skin looks dark like ours. Their features are just more European. And he said that in the museum for people to see, they had these made up mummies that they had done modern mummies, and they displayed them as these kings, but in the basement that they were actually the original mummies. And some of them were black with dreadlocks, other ones had bald heads depending on the king and the time frame. But he had talked about that is, you know, in these museums, some of these museums, they'll put these forgeries out in order to make people think that the people of the Nile Valley were white. So yeah, it's just very interesting that you discussed that. But the things that I also wanted to discuss that were just like things that I thought would be interesting was there was an article that came out regarding a football player. It says racist NFL player just started sick new trend with what he's doing after tackling any white player. So this is a black player on the Seattle Seahawks. And what he does is every time that he sacks a white player, he puts the fist up in the air, the black power sign. And they're saying that because he's doing that, that it's, they quote, it's a disgusting racist symbol that black supremacists have used for decades to display their supremacy over the white race. This is how they describe it. And they were saying that the stands were partially empty due to him practicing racism by putting up a black power sign every time he tackled a white player. Now, what the real reason is that there's obfuscating, like you always say, is that a lot of people are not going to the games in support of Colin Kaepernick not getting a job. So as a result, they're actually lying like white people do and putting it on this black player who raises a black fist. And to see the racist propaganda and how it's written, it's phenomenal. It's a great treatise to me on how white people psychologically change things to make themselves look like the victim all the time. So it was something, I'll send it to you, Gus. I'll send you all of the articles. The other article was one from naturalnews.com where they discussed, they said, Amazon.com is caught selling illegal full auto gun parts and ATF sting to convict its own customers with felony crimes. There's a part they were selling on there that they were claiming was a part to make air guns automatic. But that piece that they're selling not only makes air guns automatic, it makes Glocks and I believe certain types of rifles fully automatic, which is illegal. So anyone who buys that piece, they might be buying it thinking they're getting it for their air gun. But because it's something illegal for anyone in the country to have, the ATF has created this thing that they're discussing. So if anybody buys gun parts on Amazon.com, do not buy that piece that states it makes air guns fully automatic, because you will have the ATF kicking in your door and you'll be charged with a federal crime. I just thought it was something important for people that use Amazon.com for anything. Also, there was a brief article that discussed 10 potent plants that kill pain fast. And I'll send you this too so you have it and you can share it with anyone. The first one is basil, and they tell you how to use it, how to grow it for yourself, all kinds of good information on the plants and its history and how you can use it. The second one is rosemary. The third one is sage. The fourth one is thyme, and that's T-H-Y-M-E. The fifth one is oregano. The sixth one is parsley. The seventh one is lavender. The eighth one is dill. The next one is mint. These are all plants that can actually cure pain quite fast, depending on how it's applied, and they give you all the information on how to apply it. Also, the 10 best natural antibiotics, I'll send you this too. The first one is golden seal. The second one is garlic. The third one is ginger. The fourth one is indigo. The fifth one is licorice. The sixth one is cinnamon. The seventh one is honey. The eighth one is turmeric. The ninth one is elderberry. And the tenth one is echinacea. They also include cumin, number 11, cranberry, number 12. So these are all plants you can use that are naturally antibiotic, and they give you their history and how you can use them as well. I just thought this was information that might help people who are looking for natural remedies or might be dealing with pain that they can utilize, as well as the wild lettuce. You can also use that as a tea, which is highly effective for pain as well. So I just wanted to put that information out there. And also, lastly, I had an earache recently, and I was able to put 2 to 3 drops of colloidal silver in my ear, and it killed the earache. So it works for that. That's something that I knew about, and I just put it to good use, and I did not have to call a doctor. So I do want to let people know colloidal silver has a million uses. Get it, especially if you're Black. It can save your life. It can help you not have to deal with the medical system and deal with medical apartheid. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Right on. That is fascinating about the football, or not fascinating. It might be an out-and-out deception. I think the Seattle player they were talking about was Michael Bennett, because I posted a picture of him doing the fist in the air after a sack. And I think that is a deception, because Michael Bennett, if folks, the name is familiar, that is the player who alleged that suspected race soldiers in Las Vegas put a gun to his head and said that, you know, there was some sort of disturbance. This was the night of the Mayweather-McGregor fight last month, and he was in town for the event. And he said in the commotion, they I believe, handcuffed him and had him seated on the curb, and then they put a gun to his head, and just a total terroristic experience. But he's been talking about that, and even more vocal about it. He was talking about racism and police issues anyway, but after this happened, he's been even more vocal. And I don't think he had been doing the fist in the air after a sack or after a defensive. In fact, I've seen him. He's a, you know, pretty high profile player, at least in, well, yeah, just in on the whole. And he would do all kinds of gyrations and things that I didn't think were particularly constructive. And I had noted that, wow, him, since he's been talking more about racism, even his post sack celebrations have been more constructive, which is a pattern that I've seen a lot. But yeah, I think that report is a total deception, master deceivers, that's what we say, in misrepresenting Michael Bennett and what he has been doing, and all of the racist the NFL. White people would not allow that for one quarter. And I'll stop there. Do we have other folks that we missed completely who have a hand up?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to everyone. There were two questions that was came up. One of them was about the number of white people on the planet. Was that one of them?
I think that was one. And then we had the caller who asked about a Black directory, and or if we have people who have made it a part of their code to buy exclusively from Black people or predominantly from Black businesses, and has that been effective?
Okay, that's good. I'll speak on those two, and also what I got on the line for. I can't give, of course, an exact number. I wouldn't know where to start in that, but what has been popular to me, which I think makes logical sense as far as a percentage, is less than 1/10 of the world's population, a tiny, tiny minority of people who are identified and function as white people. That's the closest I can come to an answer to that question. I think it's constructive to attempt to incorporate as many non-white people, as many non-white people who are racially classified as Black, into your idea of employing. I think it's a constructive thing. There was just someone on urban radio, quote unquote urban radio, that I think it was Joe Madison that brought a similar issue up, where he used the term quote unquote black economic power, which I don't have a clue on what that means. especially with that last word, power. I don't know if it's powerful or not. I would say even more, I doubt it seriously, if it's power. He said what the problem with non-white black people is that when we spend money, it leaves out of, and here's another confusing term, the black community. It leaves out within about 8 hours after you give that money to a business. Whereas he gave some other examples, it turns over and over in other areas, other quote unquote places of people who are racially classified as white. And some other racial classifications that he mentioned about how it turns over, he gave examples of it. But from the standpoint of self-respect and from the standpoint of the meaning of justice, I would say it would be correct to find as many of non-white black people to spend your money with as possible, because it would also help another non-white person out from that standpoint if you are patronizing their business. Now, what I called in for was there's another very interesting documentary series that's on television, that was on television. I don't know if it's probably going to repeat itself again. It normally does. Once again, directed and produced by who I think is a white person by the name of Ken Burns, called The Vietnam War. The reason why I find it interesting is because on how it directly coincides with the strategy of white people who practice racism in the people activity of war. It's a series of things that they do, a pattern that they impose upon non-white people, and they've been doing it now for centuries. And Vietnam is, so to speak, is one of the modern versions of it. Now I would say you would have to see through code to get the exact racist content in the documentary. In other words, being that I suspect Ken Burns is a white person, he's not going to come out directly and tell you about the racism, you know, that involves in it, although they do mention it in pieces of the documentary. It is quite long. It goes in about an hour and a half, and it's about four or five different series. It is very clear color cinematography that is utilized in the documentary. And last but not least, the way I look at it is this way. They first started off with the white people who call themselves French, who were, by the way, going bankrupt from the squabbles that white people had with each other in the early part of the 20th century. And just go to show you, like the mafiosa in the movie Godfather, on how although they would war one another, they at the same time would work to repair the one that they actually went to war with. The white people from this part of the world gave them equipment, battle equipment, to go at these people, at these non-white people.
30 seconds.
And I would say, with these non-white people that they show tremendous levels of self-respect and their means to defend themselves. And so it's a good documentary if you're interested to look at. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Mr. Burns' daughter, Sarah Burns, who is a white woman, she's been a guest on the program. She did the documentary, The Central Park Five, which I think her dad helped her put together on the five non-white males who were wrongly accused of raping a white Central Park jogger, white woman. This was in the late 1980s. Donald Trump was key figure in that development as well. Do we have other folks not heard from at all? Do we have any folks who've not been able to share at all? If you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed. Do we nab everybody? Get every caller? We have about a half hour before the program concludes, so make sure we did not miss anybody. If you have a hand up, if you had commentary you wanted to share, did we get you?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Mr. Steele.
Awesome. Yes, this is Ken Steele, and I am in Hollywood currently. And I wanted to start my, I guess, this week's report by saying the boycott is working despite all of the claims to the contrary, all of the claims that, you know, there's this reason or that reason. It's definitely, the boycott has definitely had a tremendous effect on the ratings for this year. One of the declarations that I've seen suspected racists make in Fortune magazine is that they're declaring that TV is dead. They're saying that TV is dead because niggers are no longer watching the NFL. And, you know, I just wanted to say that people will continue to view media broadcasted from a centralized source on glowing screens for quite some time. So I think that the claim that TV is dead is quite hyperbolic, and it goes along with the claims that society is going to die once the suspected racists are no longer the majority in the United States or in Europe. You know, these are just hyperbolic claims, and I think that it speaks to their intention. I think that they will opt to destroy the world rather than live in a world where they are no longer the people that are in charge of it. So I think that, you know, there's something to be to note in that. And then patterns were being spoken of earlier. And, you know, one pattern that I've noticed that suspected racists have displayed quite consistently online is that if you analyze their comments, you'll notice that they have a difficulty in distinguishing the difference between your, the possessive, and your, I think, the article. And they're, you know, this is a common mistake that they make. You'll notice they'll say phrases like, "You're an idiot," or "You're a moron," or "You're stupid." And this is something that's consistent. And I have to point this out, and they have the same thing about "there" and "there." I have to point this out. You know, somebody, a suspected racist, was, you know, saying, "Hey, Ken, you know, why are you pointing this out? This seems very trivial. You know, you're on to nothing. You know, there's other ways of telling if somebody is a racist. I don't think you're on to anything." And sure enough, on my on a post that I made, a suspected white supremacist went on my comment section and made a very ugly racist remark. And sure enough, the error was there. And I had to point it out, like, see, this is what I'm talking about. I think it's worth pointing out because suspected white supremacists often like to pretend to be non-white people on the internet to win arguments or to confuse discussions. And if you can analyze their comments and if you can see patterns that might not outwardly be, you know, what people would describe as behavior of racists, then you can go ahead and have a better picture of who it is that you're speaking with or communicating with on the internet. And I think that the racists are so adamant about disproving or downplaying this pattern because, hey, this is one of the key indicators that you're dealing with a suspected racist on the internet. Just that is a consistent mode of behavior. Now, I've noticed this accident being made amongst amongst victims of racism as well, but this is very, very consistent amongst racist white supremacists or suspected racist white supremacists. And you can see this by typing in "you're a moron" in your search bar on Facebook. And you'll see that it's a lot of suspected racists that come up in the search results. And that's my contribution for now. Thank you so much. You have a wonderful week.
Indeed. Be safe, Mr. Steele. We have other folks that we have not heard from at all. Callers who dialed in have a hand up that we have not heard from at all. You should speak now if we have not heard from you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Hello to you, Gus, the host, and to the callers and other listeners on the line. First thing, let me say to you, glad that you're back and glad that everything is going, well, I mean, right poorly, but you know what I'm saying. I'm glad your health and, you know, your wisdom teeth and everything. I just, as you were, because I was listening and as you were going through, I said sometimes as we just grow, you know, the things that our body go through. And so one thing, too, is, you know, try not moving any furniture anymore because I know how that can be. But anyway, I'm glad that you are back to being Gus. One thing I wanted to say, the clip on the woman at the school, Georgetown, and I worked at Georgetown years ago. It's a beautiful campus, but this is, like you say, actually the fact that she's there and they are not giving her anything special is really just kind of like a slap in the face, you know. We told your ancestors, but oh yeah, you know, you can come to school here, but you got to pay like everybody else. And, you know, that's not, you know, that's just not right. But, you know, that's white people. As far as the Turks now, you know, you're right how they want to spin this. And, you know, Heather Heyer is now the, you know, I guess the poster child that white people are victims of this racist stuff. And every time I hear people say her name, I'm like, nobody knows a thing about Heather Heyer, as far as I know. I'll be honest with you, I haven't done any research on her. And I actually, unless I come across things or I'm looking at something, it's not like I'm going to plan to do any research to find about who this Heather Heyer was. Nobody knows anything about her. Nobody knows anything about her parents. I know, I understand that at the time, I think her father was very angry, which, you know, it's understandable. But nobody knows those people, but yet she's the poster child, and now, you know, like, oh my god, this is just really bad. This is like, you know, we've been going through this stuff, but now our stuff's like, oh well, yeah, but you know, hey, this is a white girl, you know. So that right there, as far as the things that they talked about last week, and actually pretty much think literally was trying to blame that little biracial boy and that, oh, this wasn't bad. I mean, I heard that, you know, and I just, you know, I used to listen to them, but I really don't like them because you are right how they can spin that. Excuse me. How they can spin that, and now all of a sudden, you know, they're the victims, you know. And I always just like to say that you're just victims in your own mind. You want to be victims, you know, and you play. It's a game that they play, and it's really not a game. So for us, it is our life. As far as the British Museum, just this past week, I was listening to a live video on YouTube. It was the guy that called himself General Serengeti. And he talked about this British museum that have all these African artifacts. And there was one, he talked about, I guess, one exhibit, and he said they had like 8 million pieces out, and he said they had like 6 million pieces, you know, I guess back, you know, back in storage. And he was saying, and this like 14 million pieces were donated by this one person. And then he went on and he looked at other museums across the world that had, you know, African artifacts. And so I was listening to him and I was thinking about, and he pretty much said, basically what they did was that, you know, these white people back then went to Africa, pretty much raped Africa of these artifacts, and then went out into the world and told the story that these people in Africa weren't doing nothing, and white people, we did everything. Because I don't know if any of the callers know, but there is a group of white people out here that run around here bragging about having high IQs and about how they built the Sphinx and how they built the pyramids. And I have some other YouTube that I'm subject to, and I have one lady, she did this one video about how they can't even stay out in the sun without burning. And she's very sarcastic about it. She said, but you know, these high IQ people just, you know, really want us to believe that that they, you know, the top part of that. Because now, if you notice, there's a lot of talk about sub-Saharan Africa, which is supposed to be black people, but Northern Africa, which would be Egypt, Morocco, Libya, you know, and all those countries up there, that they are supposed to be Europe. This is Europe. They discovered this and everything like that. And so the other lady I'm sub to, her thing is, you can't even stay out in the sun, you know, for a good 2 or 3 hours without burning, you know, here in this country. But you want us to believe that, you know, eons ago, you guys were over there building the pyramid and the Sphinx. But when he talks about that, it pretty much comes out to that's what they did. They raped Africa of the artifacts and then took the story and flipped it and, you know, pretty much said that, oh, these black people were over there doing nothing. You know, we white people came over there, we discovered everything, we did everything. But, you know, the artifacts are like hundreds of thousands, some of them probably even millions of years old, and we know white people are not that old. So I guess, you know, we ain't supposed to know how to think and put that together. But I just found that, you know, interesting that to be talking about that tonight. As far as the NFL, I mean, it's just been crazy. I've been looking at a lot of YouTube videos of that. I mean, it's just been really crazy, you know, for what Trump, you know, go to Alabama and throw out, it's, you know, almost kind of like racial code words and, you know, throwing out, you know, but it could be, it's kind of frightening because, like another one of my Facebook friends say, this is like you're throwing red meat to your base and you're trying to stoke, you're trying to get, you know, stoke some things. And it is really sad though, because he's the president. He sits in that seat of the presidency. The presidency has a lot of power in it. Can't deny that. And you are the president who is sitting in here talking. I mean, like what he did with Steph Curry, what he, you know, about Kaepernick. And here you are, seconds. The president, and you're attacking. Okay, you're attacking basically, quote unquote, your own citizens. You know, we can debate that, but your own citizens. And then, you know, because you have people out here who will begin to act on that. So I just want to throw that out there. And this way, I'm glad that you're feeling much better. Thank you for taking the call.
Much obliged. Much obliged. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you've not heard from you at all, you should speak now. If you have a hand up, go ahead and speak now.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings. My name is Blue Vic, first time caller. I just had a quick question or comment. I guess for the host and the callers. Lately, I've been noticing the people that classify themselves as white. They've been saying white supremacy lately, but not as a system, more as pointed towards the extremist groups lately that we've been seeing on the news. I'm seeing that causing a lot of confusion. Now, my question is, I get, you know, for the hosts and callers, when you became a little less confused about the system of white supremacy, racism, do you think other non-white, in particular black people, are becoming more
less confused in all areas of activities as of lately?
I guess other folks can give their response now since we have this question. The question also about buying from Black entrepreneurs, if you have a directory or if you have, I guess, done any purchasing, and if you know like an exact number of individuals classified as white on the planet. So those are some of the questions that were asked. The question, the most recent question, my view in terms of non-white people coming less confused about things, I don't think so. Not just on the basis of the term white supremacy being used more. I know I spoke with Mr. Fuller within the last 30 days, and he too said that he had noted that he was hearing the term white supremacy more frequently being used on different news reports and what have you, seeing it in the newspaper, much more so than what he had been seeing 5 years ago or so. And he said that he thinks that racists have probably figured out a way where they can use that word and minimize the damage so that people don't get clarity behind the use of that term. And I think, like with what you heard with the Young Turks, Anna Kasparian, she did say white supremacy, but it was connected to a white person being a victim of white supremacy. And I'm also reminded of what Dr. Welsing said some years ago. She said that many people will use the term white supremacy. That does not necessarily mean that they have a definition for the term and an accurate definition for white supremacy as a system. And as you stated, I think that frequently the term is not used or defined in that systemic manner. So I think that helps with the confusion. The word might be used, but it's still not connected to an accurate and comprehensive definition. That'd be my view. I don't think the confusion is decreasing for non-white people. The folks can share their thought as well. Do we have anybody?
Can I be heard?
Hang on 1 second, Thomas. Do we have anybody that we missed completely? Anybody with a hand up that we have not heard from at all? Spectacular. I'm hoping that means we didn't miss anybody. We only have about 20 minutes left, maybe a little less than 20. If you have a hand or if you think you might want to talk, you should go ahead and get your hand up now. Do not wait till the last 5 minutes if you have anything you'd like to share. So I'm assuming we got everybody, so everyone is free to respond or share additional comments that they have. Thomaston, New York, did you have a response you wanted to get in?
Absolutely. I want to say that whiteness studies is the actual study of whiteness. They did, you know, a spectacular job of changing the conversation from racism and just making it a conversation about race, and changing the conversation about white supremacy and changing that to white privilege. So what you're seeing is them trying to, I think, loop everything in. That's a metaphor, but trying to get a hold on what's going on, because with so many people being able to call the president, so many white people calling the president a white supremacist, this is the way to cover everyone else. Is everyone a white supremacist? You know, so they want to specify what white people are white supremacists, in my opinion. There's an organization. It's a website. You go to the website. It's black-owned. You sign up for the newsletter. You give your email address, your name. It's all confidential. And then they'll send you a link. It's called BAM, B-A-M, Black American Made. That site actually blew my mind because I was able to find quite a few black-owned businesses in Harlem, which I thought that there were very little people. Now the person who started this business, he's a black entrepreneur. He's also an inventor. So he built this for black people who had inventions that they either had already made and they wanted to sell or needed help with getting patents and copyrights and trademarks and things of that nature. And it kind of morphed into a site where black people put their own businesses and things at. So BAM, B-A-M, sign up for the newsletter. You get an email like in 24 hours. And then from there, you can access the site. And it's sort of like a Craigslist for black-owned businesses. Lastly, I wanted to say about the the London Museum, the most important documentation they have in there for that they stole from our people is called the Shabaka Stone. They also call it the Rosetta Stone. But this proves, like, this proves a lot of their history, because it shows that, and this is older than the pyramids, the stone. This is way before they started writing on papyrus. They were still, you know, chiseling this stuff into rock. So this is like 5 to 10,000 years ago, 5 to 10,000 years before the pyramids, rather. And it has, in, like a sign you'll see in New York, where it's in English, Spanish, and Chinese. This stone has it in the Medinetta, the symbolistic writings they had. This also has the same thing written in ancient Greece, and it has the same thing written in the Sinaitic text, which is what predates the Asiatic languages, which is Hebrew, Arabic, Tuareg, and those. So pretty much it shows that all of those language systems came from ancient Egypt, which dispels any myth of some Greeks or anything else coming about creating their own language and things. It didn't happen. So that's in the London Museum. If you look at those artifacts and things, and you go there with an eye to dispel white supremacy, you'll find a lot.
Appreciate that, Thomas, in New York. Do we have other folks?
Can I be heard?
Let's see. Let's get Mr. Steele, and then we'll get Roz.
Okay. I just wanted to give a warning to a fellow listener and contributor that cited Natural News as a news source for information. The white supremacists have sought to, I guess, declare that site specifically to be what they call fake news. And they've lumped it in with, along with InfoWars, along with Mark Dice's website. This is one of the websites that Google has sought to suppress in listings for dispensing false information. I don't know exactly how to interpret that, but one thing that I've learned on my travels on the internet is that suspected racists do not like false information dispensed amongst other suspected racists. They go to great lengths to debunk and dispel information that they deem to be false that is being proliferated amongst suspected racists. So I suspect that Natural News, the website, is listed as a fake news website, not because they're uncovering some sort of deep intrinsic truth, or that they're, you know, into that they're you know, fighting the white supremacists. I suspect that the white supremacists have deemed that site to be way too popular amongst other suspected racists. And they know that it's dispensing confusing or deceptive information. And I'll mute my line.
Raj, you were going to speak as well?
Yes, sir. First, I wanted to say that the article about the football player, Mr. Bennett, actually was from Natural News, and I know how popular that site is. That's why I wanted to use the article. And I felt that that particular article speaks to the refinement of white supremacy, the way that they presented this argument and tried to make it look like, because he threw this black power fist up every time he sacked a white player, that the stands were empty, when really the stands were empty in protest to the treatment of Colin Kaepernick. And I just felt that that was important because that is a popular site. But I'm fully aware, and I'm glad that you elucidated that. Also, I wanted to second the firefighter in Florida, just a brilliant addition. The Vietnam War, oh, if you want to understand how white supremacy functions on a political level and how it affects non-white people, I think Vietnam is one of the greatest, that film, and there's a lot of racism in it all throughout it, but the historical information and the psychological discussion and rhetoric by the more powerful white supremacists throughout that film should give black people a lot of insight into how they function. and how they do things with to get us to get on these trains and still not get, oops, sorry, that was a metaphor. They get us to follow these propagandized trends that they create, in which they fool non-white people into thinking that white people are something they're not. Because that's one thing I learned from the Vietnam War documentary, was that the Vietnamese, Ho Chi Minh in particular, thought of America as this idealized place where white people fought other white people for liberation so that they would take his side. And as he started to align himself with communists, they turned on him, and they did a lot of clandestine things to set off the war that became Vietnam, unbeknownst to Ho Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh at that point thought he was still friends with them. So there's a lot of information you can garner from it. I think right now it's at episode 6. Somebody else told me that it's going to go up to 10 episodes. But I think if you really want to understand the Vietnam War really well and just look at the psyche of white people and how the political game or the political situation is played out in the system of white supremacy and how it can affect non-white people and create major conflict between non-white people, even in the same group as in the Vietnam War, I think it's a great treatise on that as in and of itself. Lastly, I wanted to say, in reference to how many white people on the planet, I've been hearing about the 10% number since the late 70s, early 80s. And if I go back to T. Lothrop Stoddard's book written in the early 1920s, where he stated that there was a major problem with white people reproducing, I believe that the numbers are not 10%. I think it's probably around 7%, and that they're obfuscating and skewing the numbers by making other non-white people think that they're white too when it suits their political aims to bolster their numbers. I think, in my opinion, I don't think it's 10% anymore. I think that it's actually probably like around 7%, just based on what I'm seeing in the trends with all these wacky things that white people are doing to try and save themselves. Now that I just saw that they started learning how to 3D print wombs, artificial wombs, and all kinds of stuff. So the things these people are doing to try and save themselves and make themselves survive and remain white are phenomenal right now. And just based on the trends from what I'm studying, I think their numbers are lower than 10%, and they're just obfuscating the numbers by, when it suits their political aims, bolstering their numbers by trying to include other non-white people that they practice racism against. And of course, when it comes to police stops and things like that, they get treated like the non-white people they really are. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Can I be heard real quick?
Oh, sorry.
Thank you. The female called this book up.
Yes, this is Rick from Ohio again. I just wanted to quickly say what I wasn't able to mention when I first spoke with the documentary, because I know that there's a lot of people have been speaking about things that you can watch. I know, of course, reading is more important than watching TV. I just wanted to mention that within the documentary that I was speaking about, it does show how whites, they do take care of themselves. Now, this was in one specific county, and there, of course, there was racism in that. But the main thing, the reason why when they spelled out heroin with an E, I might be saying it wrong, but it's like a female hero. It was because they were detailing a white woman judge, a white woman fire captain, and then a white woman who was just simply driving around giving white prostitutes like lunches and stuff to try to encourage them to get off of drugs. So I just wanted to add that. If it's not constructive, like people have said, you don't have to watch it. But also in the documentary, they mentioned that that specific county, it was it had the most overdose deaths. That's no longer true. It's actually in Ohio. It's a county closer to Dayton, which is in southern Ohio, that has the most overdose deaths currently. I think it was reported in either June or January of this year. Thank you.
Wanted to make sure I remind folks as our time is winding down. We will be here on Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Dr. Amani Shakti Ani, she'll be here at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll review what has transpired with the University of Albany case, as well as how the university has retaliated against her. But that'll be Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern. Looking forward to speaking with her again. I also wanted to make sure that I got in the Emmys happening this week. Certainly not encouraging anyone to watch any of the winning shows or the award show for that matter. I didn't watch it, but it popped on my screen that Black Mirror won 2 Emmys. And so I looked to get more details and discovered that the episode specifically, San Junipero, won 2 Emmys this past week. And I felt very vindicated. We had Dr. Martin Komorkian on the program in November of 2016, and we discussed Black Mirror in detail. This was days after President Trump was elected, when everyone was still in a tizzy about that and stunned. And I said at the time, hey, we said this was going to happen months ago. You know, you should have been listening to the cows. We're going to be talking about Black Mirror because we already, you know, thought this is what I thought was going to happen. So we talked about Black Mirror, and we talked about the episode San Junipero in detail. That episode specifically won 2 Emmys for the series Black Mirror. That episode, it features a tragic arrangement between a Black female and a white woman. They had lots of talk online about this is historic anyway, just because you have a TV show, a British TV show, no less, that was just released on Netflix for the 3rd season. This is not something that's on network television. And for an episode to win 2 Emmys, like, wow. But for that episode specifically, what they were promoting, I just meant helping white people. In fact, I messaged Dr. Kevorkian to see if he saw that, and he said that he did, because he was on the program talking about it with us. I played the sound clip where he's talking about San Junipero, Dr. Kevorkian, where he says, the white woman named Yorkie says, I just need you to help me. Talking to the Black female, I need you to help me sexually. Yes, we need to celebrate and give them trophies and awards. They cleaned up this week. I'm sure they are going to have a very successful season 4. It's supposed to be coming out later this year. As I said last year, we talked about this in 2016, but I did feel very vindicated when they picked up both of those trophies earlier this week. We have about 4 minutes left. Anybody final comment they want to make sure they get in before we conclude?
Real quick.
Hang on 1 second, Mr. Steele.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Okay. I wanted to add real quick that I heard someone. Am I echoing?
I am hearing a slight echo. Let's see. Okay, let's see if... Proceed, sir. Sorry about that.
Okay. So I just wanted to add that I heard a caller earlier say something about a certain amount of Black Hebrews that were being genocide and Holocaust at the same time. And also I heard another caller say, what's really going on? Like, how are these white people or these albinoids, like, even halfway competing with us or controlling us? And so I just want to reference back to something that I said earlier about I truly believe that a lot of the religious and spiritual differences that Black people have and how they identify keeps us from either acting or not acting. And I think Neely Fuller Jr. said it best, that Europeans or the racist white supremacists take all sides of every argument. And I think it's safe to say that they've taken all sides of the argument when it comes to what we call the God, the devil, good and evil. And they will come on with a sectarian religious belief and put that on your back, and they'll have a devil worship Freemason center and then a charity for you. So I just wanted to add that.
Mr. Steele?
Yes, real quick. The documentary by suspected white supremacist Ken Burns called Vietnam, I've been following this documentary as well. I really do enjoy seeing the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army veterans, you know, just gleefully recalling their moments of butchery. Throughout the series, it's very interesting. But one thing that victims of racism should note throughout the film or throughout the documentary is that it's noted that the suspected, the racist, I guess, will embellish body counts to suit their political aims. Throughout the documentary, it's noted
that they are reporting insane kill counts. And they're basically reporting that they made them up on the spot. So, and there's some situations where they couldn't find any dead Vietnamese soldiers, and they just pulled out a number to substantiate the heavy losses that they took in the skirmish. So, you know, I suspect the same thing is going for their population numbers. I think that they are misrepresenting their impact in society. And I think that this is something that should be investigated by fellow victims. And the rest of the episodes will be available tomorrow, and I think it goes till 10 episodes. So there you go.
Right on. I'm pretty sure Mr. Burns, at this point, he's such an accomplished filmmaker that I'm sure a lot of his projects, or I'm sure this project, along with a lot of his other works, if it's not available online or if you didn't get to see it, I'm sure it will be readily available. Netflix, your local library, whatever other mediums you can think of. He's I think he did the Jackie Robinson documentary from a few years back as well, which was pretty good. And that was pretty easy to find. So I don't think if you want to check it out, I think you'll have an easy time accessing it. With that, we will be here on Monday. Dr. Arnie will be back second time. Looking forward to getting the update on the University of Albany situation, as well as what's been happening with her personally. If you have guest suggestions, if you have problems finding something in the archives, if you just have a general question, gripe, complaint, drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. Much obliged for all the folks who participated this evening and folks who listened in as well. I hope the broadcast was worthy of your time and energy. I will state again, first official full weekend of autumn, so they tell me. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I know it is very popular. Yes, let's go out and celebrate. Days are getting shorter. It's getting a little bit cooler. Let's go out and have a drink or five. It's the weekend. Under the system of white supremacy, there are just too many examples of alcohol, drugs, whatever it is, being used to further abuse and terrorize black people. I think under these circumstances, we need our brain computer working at maximum efficiency. And I think there's enough evidence, and I think many of us have enough personal experience to see that frequently with these narcotics comes diminished brain capacity. And we do not need any more of that for black people, victims of white supremacy. We already have enough problems. If you're going to be out and about, you definitely want to be sober. You do not know when you might bump into a race soldier badge or no. And those situations can become lethal in a matter of seconds. I don't think alcohol or any other intoxicants, I don't think that's going to make that situation any better for you. See sirens in the background right there. If you're going to be in a vehicle, buckle up every time, driver or passenger. We do not need any unnecessary stops by race soldiers. Those can escalate out of control quickly. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in. No moving furniture if you don't have to.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.